Thank you, Daniel. Coming up, it is a not-so-happy Easter for the royal family in their first public appearance as a family since Andrew Mountbatten's arrest. Calls have been growing for their funding to be slashed. Is it time to review the royal charter? Plus, 12 million pensioners are set to receive a financial boost. The new tax year will see their state pensions rise by almost 4%. Should Labour continue to protect the triple lock, though? But first, Donald Trump's expletive-laden social media posts attacking Iran has caused consternation, to put it mildly. What should we take from it? That and more with me, Nick Abbott, after the new news at 10 on LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock. Russia says the US should abandon the language of ultimatums when it's dealing with Iran following a new outburst from President Trump. He's now threatening to target the country's infrastructure on Tuesday unless the Strait of Hormuz is reopened to shipping after writing a post online laden with expletives. The Kremlin says a moderation of language would help to return the current situation to a negotiating track. Spencer Critchley is a Democrat strategist and has been telling LBC the war isn't helping the president's popularity at home.
His current disapproval rating, last I saw, was 64%, I think. I think that's the highest disapproval rating that's ever been measured in the United States. Crucially, he seems to have lost the support of independents by a huge margin, and they are the people who make the difference in modern American elections because the country is so divided according to partisan identity.
The Israeli Prime Minister has condemned the decision of a court allowing up to 600 people to congregate for an anti-war demonstration in Tel Aviv. Most outdoor gatherings are capped at 50 people because of the risk posed by missile attacks. Benjamin Netanyahu says the move concerning the protest was unfair because prayer services aren't given the same freedom. A man and a woman are due in court tomorrow following the death of a 13-year-old after a road collision in Bedfordshire. Noah Campbell died in the crash between a car, a bike and a scooter in Flitwick on Friday night. Two other teenage boys were also injured. Pepsi and Diageo have now both withdrawn their sponsorship of a music festival after the rapper Kanye West was announced as a headline act. He's been condemned for anti-Semitism and is due to perform over three nights at the Wireless Festival in North London during July. NASA astronauts on board Artemis 2 say they've caught their first glimpse of the far side of the moon. They've called it absolutely spectacular as the mission prepares to reach its peak tomorrow. Crew members have also been getting a message from an Apollo 16 astronaut. 90-year-old Charlie Duke landed on the moon in 1972.
Below you on the moon is a photo of my family. I pray it reminds you that we in America and all of the world are cheering you on. Thanks to you and the whole team on the ground for building on our Apollo legacy.
LBC weather, a calmer night across the UK, but also turning colder. Clear skies and mostly dry for much of the country, apart from Scotland. We'll see a low of around 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Good evening. Here is a brief history of the threats and deadlines issued by Donald Trump to Iran. On the 21st of March, Trump said he would hit and obliterate power plants, starting with the biggest ones first, if Iran did not reopen the waterway within 48 hours. That's the Strait of Hormuz. They didn't. 2 days later, Donald Trump said that there had been very good and productive conversations between the countries and postponed the strikes against energy infrastructure for 5 days. Iran denied that there had not only not been very good and productive conversations, they denied they'd even said a word to each other. On the 27th of March, Trump said that he would postpone attacking energy plants for 10 days as per an Iranian government request. The Iranian government denied that making any such request. And yesterday, with the 6th of April deadline looming, he issued the following. And I will edit this to protect your delicate ears from presidential language. Quote, Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one in Iran. There will be nothing like it. Open the bleeping straight, you crazy bleepers, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah, President Donald J. Trump. Well, let's talk about this with Roger McMillan. Roger is a counter-terrorism expert and former director of security at Iran International TV, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, Roger.
Hey, Nick, how are you?
Good, thanks. Does the latest post from Donald Trump sound like a leader who is winning a war or losing his mind?
I'm not a psychologist, but this is definitely coercive ultimatum signalling really turned up to 11. And, you know, three things make it significant beyond the rhetoric that we've heard to date. Firstly, it's a real declaration of intent to hit the civilian infrastructure. And by that, you're looking at the Bushehr nuclear plant. As you said before, as an ultimatum, follow the previous 10-day pause, which has been, you know, exactly as you said, sort of extended. And there's a sequence to this. It's pause, claim progress, escalate in any case. And that also suggests that diplomatic track has either stalled or was never serious. And, you know, some of the aspects that he said are, you know, as in the praise be to Allah, that's not a diplomatic gesture. That's a calculated provocation of the Iranian leadership. And, you know, what you're seeing is the Iranians are digging in. And there's a General Abadi called it a helpless, nervous, unbalanced and stupid action, and has made a significant warning on what's returned. Neither side is pulling back from all of this, and really the Iranians are digging in for the long fight.
Yes, the whole thing is sort of odd, because the Omanis, who were negotiating or facilitating the negotiation between the Americans and the Iranians, said that great progress had been made, and that they were expecting, a breakthrough of some sort within a couple of days or so. And almost immediately, those words had dropped from their lips. America and Israel started their attack. So it's a bit hard, even at this point, to determine what the plan is, what the strategy is, what the end looks like.
I think the end has certainly changed, and you have to look at this for the casus belli that they went to this conflict on. First of all, it was regime change. Then it was the nuclear aspect, and the nuclear aspect has been dialed back. I just don't think people really understand fully quite what the Americans certainly have gone to war for. What the Israelis have gone to war for is very much the regime change. And I think that poses an interesting sort of schism between the two.
Well, have the Israelis actually gone for regime change or just chaos within the country? Because both things would suit them, wouldn't it? And they're not the same aims, if indeed there are any, for the Americans.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, regime change versus chaos. Regime change would indicate that we're looking at an end to the theocratic thugocracy that exists in Iran, has done for the last 47 years, and potentially a transition to a more secular democracy that would be more Western-leaning. Certainly would reduce and almost eliminate most of the problems within the Middle East for this regime. The chaos, of course, is perhaps not what they would want due to the other factors they would have with you know, up to a million disaffected IRGC and besieged almost Ronin who are operating throughout the region, creating more chaos.
But, I mean, that's just delusional, isn't it? Wanting democracy to flower by bombing?
I think if they would want somebody wants a democracy to flourish in the country, and that has to see a complete regime change. And I do not mean what, you know, the Americans have referred to as they've had a regime change. In other words, some of the leadership has been moved on. This requires a complete dismantling of the IRGC-led leadership within Iran as it currently stands.
Well, by move on, you mean killed. They've been moved on. They've been executed. But have they, the Americans and the Israelis, actually replaced one extreme government with an even more extreme one?
Absolutely. You've gone from the likes of Ali Larijani and his cohort, and you have moved to people such as Mohammed Bagher Zulqada, you have Ahmed Vahidi, and so on and so forth. And these are people who were very much at the inception of the IRGC back in 1979, 1980. So these are hardcore ideologues who set the IRGC up along with Ali Khamenei 47 years ago. These people are posing a real threat to the people of Iran, to the region, and beyond.
Which has got worse since this excursion, as Donald Trump calls it, has started.
Absolutely, and you know you have seen the decapitation of the initial sort of the previous leadership, and you've now been replaced with people who are far more potentially dangerous to Iran and to the West than have ever been seen before.
Now, given what we know about Donald Trump's adherence to deals that he signs, he just tears them up on a whim. If you were an Iranian leader, would you be inclined to believe anything that he says?
I think what we've seen, you mentioned before that the deals with the Omanis were allegedly going well, progressing forward, and then he suddenly launched an attack. I think that would make the Iranian leadership particularly cautious about moving forward. But equally, at this point, given this, some of the successes that they perceive that they have had in the last few days, that they're doubling down, they're battening down their own hatches and going for some form of long war, some sort of long conflict that would suit their ends as well. They're looking at maintenance of the regime, and at some point they're potentially trading some sort of Fabian strategy for space, for time, and that's what they're looking at.
Donald Trump said that he's not concerned now for the Iranian nuclear program because they've got eyes on it from the sky. Satellites are constantly monitoring the area that the Iranians have their nuclear material stored in. And they can be eliminated should the Iranians want to move them or work on them in any way, which rather blows a hole in the argument that this was all about the possibility of nuclear weapons in the first place. Because if he can blow them up now and see where they are, then he could have done that without going to war in the first place, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is, I said it right at the beginning, this is his casus belli, has changed, his road to war, and almost his justification. What is it now? If it's no longer the nuclear piece, it's certainly no longer the regime change for the betterment of the Iranian people, to free them from this brutal dictatorship. What is it?
If you were part of that dictatorship, would you think that it would be smart to keep hold of your nuclear program and press forward with it as fast as possible because of the action that's being taken against you?
I mean, they will look to extend this as long as they possibly can. For as long as they possibly can, the IRGC are there to maintain the regime, and that will be through the use of their Mosaic Defense Program, which includes the nuclear capability, which includes their ballistic missile capability, and it includes their proxy warfare capability through the likes of Hezbollah, through Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq, and through the Houthi, and through other sort of organizations throughout the Middle East.
So not only has this excursion made the Iranian regime even more extreme and dangerous than it was before, but it's made the likelihood of them acquiring nuclear weapons even more likely, because the deal that Donald Trump tore up, by all accounts, was working just fine. The Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Trump tore that up, and now appears to want something like a photocopy of that, but with his signature on it. But it's highly unlikely that the Iranians are going to do that now, because what would be the point of signing anything with Donald Trump if he's just going to tear it up the next day?
I think at this juncture, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's what would the Iranians be willing to sort of to accept? And at this stage, they see a real threat to themselves, and therefore they will batten down the hatch, as I said before. And, you know, we talk about the nuclear piece, we talk about oil, etc. But again, what we've got to also remember is the lives of, you know, some 90-odd million Iranian people who are going to suffer some serious repercussions if this, as you say, this excursion just ends on a whim with some sort of deal that will be ripped up.
What do you make of the attack on Iran's nuclear power plant? Because Mohammad El-Baradei, who led the International Atomic Energy Agency up to 2009, wrote on X, to the Gulf governments, please do everything in your power before this madman turns the region into a ball of fire.
Yeah, I mean, he's he used the word madman, and I think he used it deliberately. And quite frankly, if anybody has got sort of the right to do so, he very much has earned this right through his experience, through guiding the IEA for some 12 years, the Nobel Peace Prize, and he is. You know, he's called it before. He called it with Iraq in 2003, and he was dismissed. The invasion happened. And I just don't think he wishes to be diplomatic anymore when he sees the same pattern repeating. And it's his argument, to an extent, is structural. The military action would accelerate proliferation rather than preventing it. And he said, look, you know, destroying or trying to destroy Iran's nuclear program, you know, will draw one lesson. A lesson that is, you know, acquire deterrence faster and conceal it better, which is the last thing we really want. And I think it's his appeal to the Gulf governments is interesting because it acknowledges that Washington and the UN are not the only levers in all of this. And the Gulf states have been privately urged Trump to keep prosecuting the war, argue a month of strikes has not weakened Tehran enough. But El-Baradei is essentially asking those questions to reverse course. But whether they have the leverage or indeed the political will to do so is the real question.
Yes, I was thinking of the bombing of the nuclear power plant in Iran. Even if, and we were told that there's no radiation leak, that it is secure, but even if it is intact, is America putting the entire region, and also therefore the world, at risk of a major ecological catastrophe by bombing near, if not on, the nuclear power plant itself, but also Iran's petrochemical sites?
Oh, absolutely. There is very much that. And you've had four attacks on the Bushehr plant already. And while there have been no leaks, further attacks could cause that and could cause, you know, the fallout to hit the GCC countries through the air, through the water. But also, you've got it absolutely right. You're looking at the petrochemicals plants, the aluminium smelting plants, etc., that have been attacked in the GCC. And already you're seeing there's a difference in the air quality, there's a difference in, you know, potential difference in pollution elements in the region. So not only is it an economic, a physical disaster, but you could actually be looking at ecological disaster too.
Trump's latest outburst, it seems extreme even for him. It seems like a desperate man who thought he could bank an easy win and is coming up against the reality of the folly of that notion. Do you think he can just declare victory and pull out and claim that the US doesn't need the Strait of Hormuz and somebody else can go and fix it for him?
He it seems as though he went into this on the back of Venezuela, thinking it'd be Venezuela 2.0, when really I'm not necessarily certain that there had been a complete understanding by the Americans of just how resilient the Iranians would be when it comes to regime defense. I think that's a critical part of it. And I think, you know, looking to the future, he's already said that the Straits of Hormuz, in just last week, he said the Straits of Hormuz were not his concern. He didn't need the oil. And, you know, whoever else wants it can go and take it back themselves. And it's a contradiction in what he said just today about open it, as you more delicately put, that open it or on hell will break loose. And, you know, what is it? What are we actually looking at here? What is the is there a sort of consistent narrative that is being played? I don't know.
Is there, apart from anything else, a fundamental misunderstanding in Trump's mind about the importance of the Strait of Hormuz to America? They need it just as much as anybody else.
Well, it's not just oil. It's, you know, the UAE, I think, produces more of the aluminium that America needs than almost anywhere else in the world. So, you know, it's not just the oil that's the resource that go through the Straits of Hormuz. It's, as I said, it's the phosphates, it's fertilizers as a byproduct. There's an awful lot of essential products for the rest of the world that go through the Straits of Hormuz. It's a real choke point, and it's something that, you know, he must take cognizance of all, because he's, through the actions of Israel and America, this has caused, as a secondary effect, this has caused the closure. And really, it's incumbent on them to see how they can open this up.
Yeah, are we in a position where an ignoramus who has surrounded himself with people who are petrified of telling him no has gone ahead and decided to attack a country that is much more heavily defended and eager to defend itself than he could possibly have understood? And he's done it because nobody told him that it was a bad idea.
I think my understanding is that the analysis was that he, you know, you would have problems. He's been told this. His leadership around him have been told this by their key advisors. Whether or not they've adopted it is, that's another matter.
Do you think our reluctance to get involved will play well with the Iranians? Because I know that they allowed a ship owned by France, or a French-owned ship, rather, to go through the Strait of Hormuz. Omani and Japanese ships have also sailed through. Are we going to be a part of them, or are we going to be more associated with America in Iranian eyes?
I think at the moment, you know, the UK has played their position rather well. We have protected our interests in the Gulf, supported our Gulf partners in this. And I think in the long term, we will look at potentially more partnering, a greater degree of partnering with the Gulf countries. Whether Iran looks in that favor or not is a secondary matter. And I would hope that the government would not look at the short-term issue of the oil, because that will be sorted, at the sort of detriment of the plight of the Iranian people, who will have suffered some 30,000, 40,000 odd people killed in just a few weeks earlier this year. And if this is allowed to go on much longer, or if the Americans just walk away, what will happen thereafter will be quite horrific.
Thank you for your time, Roger. That's Roger McMillan, the counter-terrorism expert, former director of security at Iran International TV. So, if you haven't read Donald Trump's latest missive, it's worth glancing at, but don't do it in polite company. Has the man lost his mind? 0345 6060 973, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10, Nick Abbott, LBC.
Weekdays from 7 a.m.
This is a shameful, this is a shambles.
Straight to the point.
How was that allowed to happen?
Nick Ferrari at breakfast on LBC.
Show some evidence, Minister.
Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app. Download it now from your app store. LBC.
Buying a home on a holiday park was the retreat you always wanted. But then came unexpected site fee increases. And that was before the dramatic loss in value. If you bought a home on a holiday park in the UK, you may have been missold. HolidayParkAdviceCentre.co.uk could help you receive thousands in compensation. Text ASSIST to 78900. That's ASSIST to 78900.
Hey, you! Yeah, you! What would you like from your investing app? 6% interest on your ISA, a free share of your choice, or no commission on stocks and ETFs up to €100,000 per month? With XTB, you get all of the above all in one app. The XTB app. Get your free share and start investing with XTB today. XTB, where your money works.
Capital at risk. Investment values can rise or fall. Limited free stock availability. 2% ISA rate boost for 90 days. New clients only. T's and C's apply.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Yes, so I wonder if the leader of the free world is unravelling mentally, because his latest outburst is extraordinary, even for him. Peppered as it is with exclamation marks and capital letters, it breaks new ground as far as the use of language is concerned. He doesn't appear to be a man in control of himself anymore. 0345 6060 973. I suppose, given that, do you think that it was actually a major goal scored by our Prime Minister trying to distance himself as far as possible from this so-called excursion? Preston. Hello, Paul.
Hi, Nick. Good evening.
Paul.
Donald. Yeah. He's done U-turns, and then he's done U-turns on his U-turns on his U-turns. Right, you can do switch and I mean, I've lost track of it.
Yeah, it's like being on a waltzer at the fair.
Yeah. So it was kind of like, well, I'm going to do this in 2 days. Then it's 7 days, was it? 2 weeks to 3 weeks or something. Then back to 2 days. What is it? I don't know.
And then the war was won and he didn't need our help. And then he did need our help.
No
and
end.
Then he didn't need our help because our boats were toys. And then he did need our boats to open up the strait because he didn't need the Strait of Hormuz. And it was our problem because it was our oil we had to go and get. It's like dealing with a teething child.
So all those U-turns, not in the space of 3 or 4 weeks, on top of U-turns, but what gets me is the same people, and it probably goes for some of the press, and I don't really want to mix UK politics into it, but I can't help but draw some sort of comparison with Keir Starmer making 15 U-turns or whatever it is over 18 months.
Well, there's
and
no, there's
Donald
no,
Trump
there's no,
comes along and says, hold my beer.
Well, there's no, there's
but
no,
there's
no comparison at all, and it's perfectly reasonable for a politician to decide one thing and then in the presence of new information to decide to do something other than their first choice. But what you're describing about Donald Trump is not what you could ascribe to the behavior of Keir Starmer. Not even close. But thanks, Paul. I mean, if you want to bring British politics into it, then you could say that there is a certain politician who's riding high in the charts who is more associated with Donald Trump than any other. And what are we to draw from that? 0345 6060 973. You can text 84850. Email nick@lbc.co.uk. If you are on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone, 0345 6060 973. Wigan. Hello, Malcolm.
Hello, yes.
Malcolm.
I mean, it's, answering your question firstly directly about Keir Starmer, the problem is that Keir Starmer didn't stick to what he'd initially said. He said that there would be no UK involvement, and then he allowed, weakly in my view, the US to use our bases. So he doesn't get any merit from me for that.
Well, indeed, he specifically said you can use the bases for defensive purposes, but not for attack.
Well, what's the difference from the point of view?
Well, what's the difference between a defence and attack?
Well, he's allowed US planes to take off from our country to attack.
Specifically for defence, not attack.
Okay, but the Iranians may not see it in that way.
Yes,
but,
that's,
you know,
right.
That's the point.
Yes.
Anyway, forget Keir Starmer, because he'll be gone soon enough, okay. But let's get back to the issue of Trump. Well, one thing is, George Galloway made an interesting comment. He said he's like Caligula.
In what way?
Well, that arbitrary, tyrannical, I mean, I'm not an expert on Caligula, but I know he was a Roman emperor. Okay. And it was interesting, for example, that Lulu said, we don't want another emperor. And the next day, what did Trump do? He put sanctions on Brazil.
Lulu said that.
Yeah, President Lulu of Brazil.
Oh.
He said, we don't want another emperor. And lo and behold, the next day, Trump put tariffs, should we say, not sanctions on Brazil.
Right, that was after recording Boom Banga Bang. Right. Okay, thanks very much, Malcolm. 0345-6060-973. You can text 84850. Email nicka@lbc.co.uk. If you're on WhatsApp, it's the same number as the phone. 0345-6060-973. Andy in Tiverton says, do you think Trump is still seeking the Peace Prize? Yes, and I think he'll bomb Norway if they don't give it to him. Now, more of your calls on this to come. Are we actually looking at almost the first time that I can recall, not just a leader of a country, but the leader of the free world unraveling before us. Going to take a break for the news, come back with more of your calls on this subject, but immediately after the news, the Archbishop has used her first Easter sermon to pray for the Middle East. Should the church use its platform to push for peace? It's 10:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
Russia is saying the US should abandon the language of ultimatums when it's dealing with Iran following a new outburst from President Trump. He's now threatening to target the country's infrastructure on Tuesday unless the Strait of Hormuz is reopened to shipping. A man and a woman are due in court tomorrow following the death of a 13-year-old after a road collision in Bedfordshire. Noah Campbell died in the crash between a car, a bike and a scooter in Flitwick on Friday night. And Pepsi and Diageo have now both withdrawn their sponsorship of a music festival after the rapper Kanye West was announced as the headline act. He's been condemned for anti-Semitism and is due to perform over three nights at the Wireless Festival in North London during July. LBC weather, a calmer night across the UK, but it will turn colder. Clear skies and mostly dry for much of the country, apart from Scotland. We'll see a low of around 2 degrees.
This is LBC.
Experience. It's knowing when something is worth waiting for. And when it isn't. That's why Saga Health Insurance offers unlimited GP appointments whenever you need them. With a choice of flexible plans, prompt tests and treatment, your health is taken care of. And right now, you'll get a £250 gift card when you take out Saga Health Insurance. Search Saga Health Insurance for a quote today. Start a new policy before the 28th of May. New customers over 50 only. Terms and conditions apply.
Cancer doesn't care about childhood. It doesn't care what they miss out on or how much you want to protect them. But we do. At Great Ormond Street Hospital Charity, we fund life-saving research, vital family support, and the special things that help seriously ill kids be kids. Until no childhood is lost to cancer. Join us. Search GOSH Charity.
Irrational is a printer that's next to your laptop, but somehow offline. Smart is a printer with self-healing Wi-Fi that helps keep you connected. Stressful is your printer choosing check-in day to check out of ink. Smart is an HP Smart Tank with 3 years of cartridge-free ink. Oh, that's smart. So go on, search HP Smart Tank. Find the last printer you'll ever need.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345-6060-973.
Pete Hegseth, the US Defense Secretary, or Secretary of War, as he is now, has asked the American people to pray every day on bended knee for a military victory in the Middle East in the name of Jesus Christ. The Archbishop of Canterbury, meanwhile, Sarah Mullally, delivered a plea for peace in the Middle East during her inaugural Easter sermon as the Church of England's most senior bishop. Well, let's talk about this with Stephen Lowe. Stephen is a former Bishop of Hume and joins us on the line now. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Nick.
So, the US Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, said America should pray every day on bended knee for military victory. What do you make of those who call for God's help in a war they started?
I have a problem here because the brand of Christianity which Hegseth aligns himself to is, as far as I'm concerned, nothing to do with a gospel of peace and love which a man called Jesus Christ actually proclaimed throughout his ministry. And where he gets all this sort of militaristic nonsense from, and uses prayer and visiting violence on people in the name of God, it seems to me to be something so far off anything to do with Christianity that I'm at a complete loss.
Yeah, it seems to be extraordinarily popular in America, and in particularly the kind of people that would vote for Donald Trump. I mean, they would insist that they are doing God's work. Furthermore, they would insist that Donald Trump has been sent by God to save America. What do you make of that kind of talk?
Well, they are extremists. I do not believe that Trump would carry the majority of American Christians down that road. In fact, I'm sure he wouldn't. And we've only got to look at the Pope today and the Archbishop of Canterbury today and what they have been saying, which is exactly the opposite of all that Trump and Hesketh stand for. I sat in Chester Cathedral today listening to a lot to do with Easter and resurrection and hope, and listening to children praying for peace in the world, and then looked across the Atlantic to see these foul-mouthed men abusing other people whom they decide are not worthy of their care or attention other than by bombing them out of existence. And I find that so repulsive, Nick. It just has nothing to do with Christianity.
And yet it's very performative for them, isn't it? They're very insistent on wearing the cross very visibly. In fact, they'll have it tattooed on them in many cases, and they pray volubly in public. There's this laying on of hands for the cameras that they have with Donald.
Well, it's disgusting. It really is disgusting. It's vile. It's everything that Jesus didn't stand for, and for Christians throughout the ages have actually died for, is for peace and love and so on. And the same applies, dare I say it, to the other great world faiths too. Believe it or not, I had today I won't say which one it was, a Muslim MP, a lovely Happy Easter card. That is what I look for in the world's faith. It's what binds us together in a love of peace, a love of fraternity, a valuing of humankind, a valuing of the planet on which we live. Not this sort of militaristic rubbish which actually wants to condemn people. Hitler also used Christianity sometimes as well, and we mustn't forget that. He abused it in exactly the same way, and the Holocaust found justification in views of the chosen race and so on. Vile stuff.
Do you think that it's easier for people who want to use religion as a weapon to do so because most people are not familiar with the content of the Bible?
I think that's true. I am sad that more people are not aware of what Christian teaching actually is, and what, in fact, Islamic teaching is, and what Jewish teaching is, and indeed what Buddhism and Hinduism actually teaches. All of the great world religions eschew violence and want a world of peace and harmony. That seems to be lost on people who seem to regard religion as a means of beating other people up. Oh, dear.
Yes, they're kind of people that use religion as a weapon. But do moreover, the sort of people that we're talking about actually also use religion as a shield to deflect accusations that they are doing evil. I mean, I'm thinking about the very visible crosses worn by those who lie for a living for Donald Trump.
Yes, I think that's probably true. I think you have a point there. the notion of a cross as a defensive shield, I find offensive, as I think the Pope would as well. And I think there are millions of people across the world today who are weeping about the way in which their religion, their faith, is being abused by people who are have only got death and glory as their gods and not peace and harmony.
The bishop, the Archbishop, rather, of Canterbury, Sarah Mullally, called for an end to the violence in the Middle East without specifying who is committing that violence. Would it have been too political to say so, or is she guilty of an overabundance of caution, do you think?
Well, give her a week of peace, in a sense. She's barely had a chance to settle in, and I think she called for an end to violence and destruction in the Middle East. That's what we all want, in whosever's name it is. And I just think that she's on the right side. She's preaching the right message, which is not about the sort of foul-mouth language which Trump used in terms of visiting violence and destruction on people, on children, on women who they somehow disagree with. I am just sort of left completely shocked and horrified that a world leader of any kind, and frankly, you find yourself going back to, you know, people like Hitler, in terms of the sort of attitudes and values which are driving now parts of the American administration.
Yes, but on the subject of Sarah Mullally, the Archbishop of Canterbury, what she said, can you say what is right without saying who or what is wrong?
Give her time. I think she will come to saying a bit more explicitly what is wrong. And I think she will do that. There are other bishops who have said what is wrong today. And I have heard many church leaders, including, in a sense, the Pope Leo, actually saying what is wrong and calling for an end to these particular actions.
The king is the head of the church. Should he be the one saying stop the war? He didn't make any speech at all this Easter, did he?
Well, the king is not a church leader. He is a supreme governor of an established church by the constitution. It doesn't require him to be a preacher or a priest. He will have his opportunities to play his part in the world of diplomacy when he goes over to America. May God bless him on that journey.
Well, he'll need all the luck that he can get.
Precisely.
For all the calls to God for peace from the people that we've just talked about, from the most senior religious leaders on earth, it doesn't seem to be working, does it? Is there any point in prayer other than it making people feel as though they're doing something?
Ultimately, Nick, we have to have hope. I have hope. I have hope in the future that there will be peace. I have hope that love ultimately will triumph. I have hope that in the end, those who advocate violence themselves will find violence will bring their journeys to an end, because violence doesn't do anything other than destroy those who bring violence upon the world. So I have hope, I have love, and I have peace, and those things I believe in, and that is my faith.
Very good to talk to you, Stephen. Thanks so much for that. Stephen Lowe, the former Bishop of Hume. Now we're going to take a short break and then come back to more of your thoughts about whether the leader of the free world has tipped over from eccentric to insane.
LBC, last week on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast.
This outspoken man is returning. I speak of the former, now suspended Labour MP, Carl Turner.
What do you see as your political future?
I want to be back in the Labour fold, but I'm not going to count out, and I'm not going to start doing as I'm told on juries, because it's the worst idea.
Chief Executive Officer at NHS England, Sir Jim Mackey.
In every area, we've got enough to get through for a reasonable period.
What's a reasonable period?
So generally a few weeks.
Defence Secretary John Healey. How many frigates do we have in the fleet?
We have 17 frigates and destroyers.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast, back Tuesday morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
McGriddles, a new McDonald's breakfast. So it's maple syrup infused. It's sweet, then it's savoury. Because the sausage, you know, and the cheese and the egg. Oh, it's got the golden arches stamped on it too. Make that make sense. It's hard to put into words, but... Until 11 a.m, subject to availability. Fees apply to delivery orders while stocks last.
Turn up your taste buds with Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces. From mild creamy garlic and black pepper, to bold smoky garlic and sun-dried tomato, and spicy smoked paprika and chili.
Woo-hoo!
Try Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces with serious flavor. Dolmio, yeah!
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
With over 50 years' experience, Fidelity can help you feel confidently invested. Make the most of your annual allowances by the 5th of April with our expert insights, excellent service, and wealth of investment options. For ISAs, pensions, or advice, go to fidelity.co.uk. Your capital is at risk. Terms apply.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So if you haven't seen it, Donald Trump's latest missive is as follows, and I'll clean it up for you. Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up in one in Iran. There will be nothing like it, 3 exclamation marks. Open the bleeping straight, you crazy bleepers, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch, in capital letters. Praise be to Allah, President Donald J. Trump. So, is it past time to actually stop excusing his behaviour and say that he has actually lost his mind? Stefan Stockport says, new name for Trump, Genghis Khan't. I'll write that one down. I've got a list going on my Friday and Saturday shows. Is he unravelling mentally, says Steph? Was he ever ravelled? Tenerife, hello, Colin.
Hiya, Nick. Right, my question is quite straightforward. Who has the power in the USA to invoke Article 25 to remove a deranged, clearly insane and unfit president from office?
Well, specifically, it's members of the cabinet. And if the majority of the cabinet say that the president is unfit to serve, it would be possible to invoke Article 25. But there's a but. First but is, the members of the cabinet that Donald Trump has appointed removed their spines on taking office and have been flopping about like a bath mat ever since. So they have no, I wouldn't expect any of them to say a single word against him. The other but is that if the president disagrees with their assessment, which he most certainly will, then there has to be a two-thirds majority in Congress, both houses. And as the both houses are split about 50-50, and the Republicans will, every single one of them, will vote no on that, then there's absolutely no one, in fact, to take over or to take charge, and we are just going to have to live with it or die with it.
Well, die with it sounds more likely, unfortunately, for probably more people than have died in the first two major wars by the consequences of his actions.
Well, let's hope not, Colin, because that would be a...
I certainly hope not.
Something of a worst-case scenario. But yes, as for removing him because he's incapable, it doesn't seem to be possible.
Right. Well, all we can do is... I'm not a religious man, but I'm going to put my hands together and hope somewhere sees sense in all this and it stops.
Right, OK,
it's
well...
It's absolute mayhem for the planet.
Right, well, all power to you, Colin. 0345 6060 973. Chippenham, hello, George.
Hello, good morning, happy Easter.
Yes, George.
Not so happy. I've got a bit of a theory here. Is this a man drunk on power with a little bit of dementia thrown in? He's just completely lost sense of everything. And it seems the longer he's in there, the crazier he's getting.
The other side of that is that Iran knows full well that he has the world's biggest military and spends more on the military than the next 12 highest spending 12 countries combined. So they do know that even if he comes across as a bit unhinged, he has the ability to do exactly what he says. So they may be persuaded to essentially give up before being bombed, as Trump said, back into the Stone Age.
Yeah, as that might be true, is that only true when his allies sort of join in? And these are the allies that he's been insulting, threatening to invade, threatening to meddle in their democracy. I mean, it takes a lot for Giorgia Meloni to sort of come on the side of sense, the Italian prime minister. But, you know, even she's like, you're the president of America, you're not the prime minister of Italy. I don't know if you're aware, he said he was going to drag them out of the EU. And she's a Eurosceptic, and even she was like, no.
Well, yes, it also comes to something when you're told to calm down by Vladimir Putin.
Well, I didn't know that had happened, wow.
All right, yeah. Good talking to you, George. Thanks for that. There was an article in The Atlantic, which I think sums up part of the problem that we have with Trump, and Trump has with everybody else. It starts, Donald Trump does not think strategically, nor does he think historically, geographically, or even rationally. He does not connect actions he takes on one day to events that occur weeks later. He does not think about how his behavior in one place will change the behavior of other people in other places. He does not consider the wider implications of his decisions. He doesn't take responsibility when those decisions go wrong. Instead, he acts on a whim and impulse, and when he changes his mind, when he feels new whims and new impulses, he simply lies about whatever he said or did before. For the past 14 months, few foreign leaders have been able to acknowledge that somebody without any strategy can actually be the President of the United States. Surely, the foreign policy analysts murmured, Trump thinks beyond the current moment. Surely, foreign statesmen whispered, he adheres to some ideology, some pattern, some plan. Words were thrown around, isolationism, imperialism, in an attempt to place Trump's actions into an historical context. Solemn articles were written about the supposed significance of Greenland, for example, as if Trump's interest in the Arctic island were not really derived from the fact that it looks very big on a map. And then it goes on to say that when he insults countries, he then acts surprised that those countries have been insulted. Our country, for instance. He talked about our military holding back in Afghanistan as though they were cowards. He talked about our Navy boats being like toys to him. And then is aggrieved when we take umbrage. It's as though he has... his mind can't connect what he says with how other people receive what he says. Which is a pretty worrying characteristic in somebody with that much power. Tottenham, Maya.
I just wanted to say, the Americans committed war crimes in Iran, because if they've blown up the water and the school and the bridges and they've... Is that not a war crime, and should Pete Hegseth not be tried at The Hague? Because if this had been an African leader of an African country behaving the way Trump and Hesketh are, they would be tried at The Hague. And for a long time, I mean, the only people who ended up at tried at The Hague for war crimes and crimes against humanity tend to be people from, like, Africa and, you know, so I'm just wondering, should the Americans also be tried at The Hague?
Well, I think that if the International War Crimes Tribunal tried to arrest Pete Hegseth or anybody that Donald Trump feels warmly about, then he would bomb them.
I mean, the international order that was created after the Second World War...
Gone.
...which has kept us all safe for the last 80 years...
Completely gone.
Which America was part of, actually, because they were one of they went along with.
Yeah, it's not America anymore. It's Trumpulvania, or whatever you want to call it. But what the America that we knew does not exist anymore. That's history.
What I'm saying is, there's going to come up time where they have to pay the price. Not the, I want to use those words. They will have to be tried at some point. Trump is an old man,
yes.
Right? He's going to be 79. He's clearly, I think he's clearly unwell as well. He's of a particular age.
Mm-hmm.
So he will not, I mean, basically, thank God it's still a democracy. He's only got...
What's
he going to do? I mean, somebody else will come in. In 4 years' time.
Yes, and they could quite possibly be worse. I mean, if Project 2025 is as successful going forward as it has been up to this point, then I very much doubt that America will have a free and fair election from this moment on. And that even if on the outside chance that they do have what they call the midterm elections in November, then the result has been concluded before anybody has voted. Yeah, I think as far as a democracy is concerned, I'm not sure America is one anymore. But thanks, Maya. And I'm absolutely certain that Donald Trump will not pay for his crimes. I mean, he hasn't paid for anything so far. And the litany of his misdeeds trails him around like a bad smell. Crawley, hello, Peter. Peter?
Nick, good evening to you.
Yes, Peter.
To Cannes. So, just a quick side thought. When I was growing up, my dad would tell me about and how he was bombed and he'd go into the shelters and all what happened throughout the war,
Peter, it's a very, very bad line. I'll have somebody call you back, all right? Very bad line. We get a lot of that. When will they make a phone that can be used as a phone? So, we'll try and call Peter back, yes? Camden, hello, Max.
Hi, Nick. Regarding Trump, I mean, to me, I'm sure to a lot of people, he's crossed the line now. In other words, it's clear it's chaos.
Could that be part of the plan? I mean, I hesitate to use the word plan, but could coming across as a madman actually be part of the strategy, if indeed there is such a thing?
I think it can work for a certain amount of situations, but it also backfires, and I think that's what it's done now. In other words, it's gone so crazy. Anyone with any kind of sense of how is it going to play out thinks this is a risk, massive risk, for the world, and it's not fair for one man to be in charge of that. So what I was going to say, my point was that, in other words, he's crossed the red line. It's crazy, full stop. But as far as what we should do is, I think Keir Starmer's doing exactly the right thing. Keep calm, keep going, and keep a low profile, because the only possible good side of it is that somehow Trump will kind of, something will happen to him. And the whole thing will blow over. Know what I mean?
Well, wishing for a little bit too much. Yeah. But thanks, Max. I've got to move on. I want to squeeze one more in before the news. Notting Hill. Hello, Ramin.
Hello.
Ramin.
Hi. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm an Iranian here in London. I have a lot of family and friends in Iran. And, you know, I can tell you the sentiment amongst most Iranians are they're really happy with this intervention by America and Israel. And And honestly, we're all incredibly disappointed by Europe's response to this whole situation. It's been quite disgusting. I mean, we're calling people like Macron and Starmer, Ayatollah Macron and Ayatollah Starmer, we know with the stance they've taken. And I think it's...
But what is it that you are pleased about so far?
That there's finally a glimpse of hope that we can get rid of this regime that has been killing Iranians.
Where is this glimpse of hope?
It's the only way possibly that we could see a way of getting rid of this regime. Because
the regime is not being got rid of. The regime is stronger now than it was before the war, and is more extreme now than it was before the war.
It couldn't get more extreme to begin with.
No, it could. It could get more extreme, and it has.
Absolutely cannot. It hasn't. And also to say they're stronger now is also incredibly misleading. That's not true. They've lost a lot of power.
What power have they lost? They're still completely in charge. They still have a nuclear program. They killed 30,000 people for protesting against them. There are no cracks. I understand the feeling of hope that regime change can be brought from by bombing from the sky, but that hasn't happened successfully in any country in which it's ever been tried. So I get the hope part, but not the satisfaction with what's happened so far. But thanks, Ramin. Just run out of time on this one. Coming up after the news on the hour, the triple lock for pensions was brought in back in 2011 to protect year-on-year rises for state pensions. It's seen as a lifeline for many, but some politicians have branded it as unaffordable. Tomorrow, the latest rise of 3.8% will benefit over 12 million pensioners as the new tax year comes into effect. But as the UK faces an ageing population, is the triple lock sustainable? I want to hear your thoughts. 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, Jordan's military says it's been intercepting missiles and drones over its territory tonight after they were fired from Iran. The news has come on the same evening. President Trump has said he expects Tehran to make a deal with the US and Israel in days, not weeks. His latest comments have come after an expletive-laden post online demanding Iran reopens the Strait of Hormuz by Tuesday. Roger McMillan is a former director of security at Iran International Television. He's been telling Nick Abbott on LBC he thinks the president's mentioning of God in the message was designed to offend.
Praise be to Allah, that's not a diplomatic gesture. That's a calculated provocation of the Iranian leadership. And, you know, what you're seeing is the Iranians are digging in. And there's a General Al-Badi called it a helpless, nervous, unbalanced and stupid action, and has made a significant warning on what's returned. Neither side is pulling back from all of this.
Reports from the US say the American airman who's been rescued from Iran evaded Tehran's forces by hiking up a 7,000-foot ridgeline. They're citing a senior official from the Trump administration who says they managed to hide in a crevice. The two-child cap on benefits will officially end tomorrow. It's estimated the move will lift 450,000 youngsters out of poverty, as LBC's Thomas Watts now reports.
The cap was first introduced by the Conservatives in 2017, limiting child tax credit and universal credit to the first two children in most households. In November, the Chancellor announced it would be abolished while outlining her budget, following months of pressure from Labour backbenchers. But the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, said the decision favoured benefit claimants over working people.
Campaigners are asking the government to scrap the need for pavement licences for cafes, restaurants and pubs. They allow businesses to put tables and chairs in front of their companies. The Conservative Environment Network says everything possible should be done to help the hospitality industry. The Nigerian army says it's rescued 31 civilians who've been taken hostage during an attack on a church, but it's also announced five people were found dead at the scene in Kaduna State. And in sport this evening, West Ham are now out of the FA Cup after being beaten on penalties by Leeds United. The game finished on 2-2 at full-time before Leeds went on to win 4-2. They now go through to the semi-finals. LBC weather, a calmer night across the UK, but it will turn colder. Clear skies and mostly dry for much of the country, apart from Scotland. We'll see a low of around 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
Older people will start to see increases in their state pension from Monday the 6th in the first week of the new tax year. The annual rise won't kick in for everybody all at once because the state pension is paid 4 weeks in arrears and people receive it on different days of the week. But around about this point, you will see your pension, if you are in receipt of one, rise by 4.8% under what they call the triple lock. Let's talk about this with Kevin Schofield. Kevin is the political editor of the Huffington Post and joins us on the line now. Hello, Kevin.
Hi there, Nick.
So what do you make of the increase in the state pension? £575 a year increase. It's about £1.50 a day.
Yeah, I mean, it is obviously welcome news for the pensioners who will be receiving it. I dare say it's more of an increase than lots of workers and lots of your listeners will get in their pay packets this year. But the question remains, how sustainable is this over the long term? The triple lock was brought in by David Cameron's government. And all the projections suggest that it's clearly going to increase as a burden on the public purse. Now, several MPs have said it's unsustainable or have hinted that it can't last forever. But as yet, no party has bitten the bullet and said they will scrap it because they know that those who receive it, pensioners, tend to vote and they want their vote, frankly. Now, that Reform flirted with the idea of scrapping it. And last week they announced that, no, they were going to keep it. So that, I think, shows how powerful this pensioner lobby is and how no party wants to get on their bad side.
Well, the pensioner lobby would say, we've just spent a lifetime working and paying in, and now you, politician from an unnamed party, have the temerity to suggest taking that promise away from us.
Yeah, well, I think the thing to bear in mind, though, is that this is a relatively new policy. As I say, it was David Cameron was Prime Minister when it was brought in. There was no triple lock prior to that. Now, clearly there were years, famously, there was the year when Gordon Brown, I think, was Chancellor, and the pension went up by 75 pence a week. Now, that caused a huge political row. Understandably, that was a miserly increase. So I think there is a happy medium. No one is suggesting that pensioners should not get a rise each year and that it should be a reasonable amount of money. But as I say, all the projections are that as we live longer and as there are more pensioners going to be around, then the triple lock, given that it is a pretty generous, it means that every year the pension will go up by at least 2.5%, it means that it will become more and more onerous on the public purse. And, you know, you speak to MPs privately, they will all admit that it is unsustainable and it will have to end at some point. But none of them are willing to say so publicly, and certainly none of the parties are willing to make that their official party policy.
Well, people say that it is unsustainable in the long term, but it only becomes so if you don't prioritise that over, let's say, keeping the nuclear deterrent or keeping the royal family in the luxury to which they've become accustomed, and all these other kinds of payments for things that aren't absolutely necessary, but which we insist must continue as is. So if all of that, then why not the pension?
Well, yeah, I mean, listen, politics is all about priorities, and, you know, every election parties stand on a manifesto which sets out their spending priorities, and then it's up to the voters to decide which ones they like. Now, you're right, let's have that debate. Let's have that debate about whether you want to cut defence spending, whether you want to cut welfare spending, whether you want to cut foreign aid spending. You know, there's all these sorts of whether you want to cut education spending or pension or get rid of the triple lock. So there are all these debates which are absolutely justifiable. But at the moment, the triple lock, there's a sort of conspiracy of silence. As I say, when you speak to MPs behind the scenes and off the record, they admit that, you know, it can't go on in perpetuity. It simply is not affordable. But none of them, as I say, because the pensioners vote and they don't want to lose that pensioner vote, the so-called grey vote, then no one is going to say, right, we've given you the triple lock and you've had it for whatever it is, 15 years. Now we're going to take it off you. It's very easy to give a generous benefit. It's much more difficult politically to take it away, and that's what we're finding right now.
Yeah, well, that word generous is odd to me. I mean, our state pension is about 54% of average earnings, and average earnings are already quite low. I mean, the average earning is, I mean, people say it's sort of 30, 32,000, but it very much depends on what you mean by average. I think it's drawn up by the few number of people who are earning a massive amount of money. So most people in the country don't earn that kind of cash when they're working. And so 54% of that, if that's what the state pension is not what you would call generous at all. We're the sixth largest economy on earth, and we are far less generous than most of the countries in the OECD. I mean, Italy, for instance, offers 75% of average earnings as a state pension. So why are old people in this country getting such a bad deal?
Well, I think it's, as we discussed earlier, it's all about political priorities, isn't it? It's about where does the government of the day believe that the money should be spent. I guess you could also throw into the mix that we have a national health service in this country, which ensures that health services are free at the point of use, which may not be the case in other parts of the world as well, who may have more generous pension provision. But again, there is only a finite amount of money that the Treasury has to spend each year. Now, I'm not for a second arguing that pensioners should be getting less money or that they should see their pensions cut or anything like that. But we have to look overall at everything the government spends as money on, and we have to decide where are the priorities here. You know, can we justify a guarantee of this nature year upon year for pensioners? And don't forget, in a year when inflation goes up, that means that the pension will, under the triple lock system, will go up by that rate of inflation. So that could be well above 2.5%. So
in real terms, that would be zero. I mean, if it just goes up with inflation, in real terms, it's not an increase at all, is it?
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And I'm not saying they should have their pensions cut in real terms. I think that there were good, sound, practical reasons for the triple lock to be brought in. It was obviously a very popular policy. It's probably not a coincidence that David Cameron, referendum aside, was actually an electorally successful politician. You know, he did have quite a sound political antenna. Obviously, that fell to bits during the Brexit referendum. That being said, it was a very popular policy. It went down well with pensioners. It helped secure the pensioner vote for Conservatives. And that is why, subsequently, every party has gone into the election saying, we will keep the triple lock. Mm. But as I say, behind the scenes, they will privately acknowledge that ultimately it will need to go at some stage because, quite simply, with all the other competing demands on the public purse, it is not affordable. But no one is willing to be the first party to do it. You would need, I think, all the parties to jump at the same time and right now. I just don't see that happening.
No. Well, I would question whether it's affordable or not. It just depends on what you prioritise. But we've been around there. What do you think of the notion that they are actually decreasing the amount that people get as a pension because they're increasing the state pension age?
Well, again, this comes down to the fact that we've got an ageing population, doesn't it? Get older, as we live longer, as thanks to advances in medical science, etc., that means, again, that there simply isn't the money there to be able to pay out for everyone when they hit 65, or women when they were 60. Now, clearly, there's been the controversy over the WASPI women, etc., that was increased to 65. The overall pension age is now, I think, 67 for younger workers, probably going to go up to 68 at some stage, and then up again and again and again as we live longer. And it's all about ensuring that there is a pension in the future for all of us. You know, we don't want a situation where the pension becomes completely unaffordable and the government can't pay it at all. That would be, I think, an intolerable situation for the public. So, again, these are all debates about priorities. And if we're going to spend that money on pensions, fair enough. But where are you going to cut money elsewhere in order to be able to afford it?
You know, one of the ways in which we could make it more affordable is by doing the thing that most pensioners say they don't want, and that is bring more people in from outside the country to work, because we have an ageing population but also a declining birth rate. The replacement rate has not been reached for a while now, so we're going to have a decreasing number of people who are in work paying taxes and paying for the pensions of older people, and yet older people are the ones that will vote for the Tories or Reform, and they do that because they don't want foreigners coming over here.
Well, that is a great point that you make. It's entirely true that we do need immigration in order to do the jobs and pay the taxes that ultimately pay the pensions of our pensioners. And that is just an unavoidable fact. So I would be very wary of politicians who say that you can cut immigration to zero while still maintaining the triple lock, because then it does generally become unaffordable. We need people in the workforce with good, decent paying jobs to then pay their taxes, which then go on all the things that the government spends money on, including the state pension.
Do you think it's actually worse than what we've been talking about? Because there's this large number of people who don't get mentioned at all, really. Now people are auto-enrolled in private pension schemes at work, but there's a big gap of people who spent most of their working life before the requirement kicked in 2012, who didn't have a private pension provision. They sort of put it off. I'm one of those people. They just didn't want to think about it. Nobody really does. And so unless you're sort of forced by the government to contribute to a pension, as is the case now, people tended not to. And it's not just me, it's millions of people. Do you think that we're looking at a sort of slow-moving wave of catastrophe that's moving towards us, with all these people who are coming to the end of their working life who just won't be able to afford to retire?
Well, yeah, I mean, I hate using, it's a bit of a cliched phrase, isn't it? A ticking time bomb, but it absolutely is. You know, that's why the government brought in that policy, because there weren't enough people putting money aside. They weren't lucky enough to be, perhaps, they didn't have a job that that had a private pension provision attached to it. So you're right, there are millions of workers, unfortunately, in that position who will only be able to rely on the state pension when they retire, because they don't have any private pension set aside. And absolutely, they will have to rely on the state pension and perhaps other benefits in order to survive. And that is going to be a huge problem. Now, the government started to address it, as you say, with the auto-enrolment, but that is a relatively recent policy. And it's not, obviously, those before it who weren't enrolled in it are going to be facing a pretty difficult retirement when they eventually have to stop working.
But do you think it's even worse than that? Because people are delaying retiring in order to keep earning, among them the kind of people that we've just been talking about, but just other people in general who want to, have a more comfortable retirement, so they keep working. As a result of the increase in the state pension age as well, they have to keep working. But might that become more difficult as the artificial intelligence development revolutionises the jobs market and suddenly those jobs that they would have done aren't there anymore?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's going to be a squeeze at both ends. You're right. These workers who maybe don't have a private pension provision have to keep working. But you're right, AI will maybe take away those jobs. But then you've also got younger workers entering the workforce now, maybe leaving school, leaving university, and the same job opportunities aren't there because of AI that were there maybe 10, 20, 30 years ago. And again, that then hits the amount of money that the government gets through through tax income, which then feeds into the difficulties they'll have paying out for things like the triple lot, but other departments as well, like defence. As we know, with the geopolitical situation the way it is, defence is going to become more and more important, I think, over the next decade or so. And it's a huge worry. And pensions is only one of many, many headaches that Keir Starmer has got right now.
Good to talk to you, Kevin. Thanks so much for that. Kevin Schofield, the political editor of HuffPost UK. So we keep being told that the state pension is unaffordable, and particularly the triple lock is going to be becoming rapidly unaffordable. Yet we don't really pay as much for a state pension as any of our major competitors. We keep being told we're the sixth richest economy in the world, but we're down at 11th. In Europe for the level of the state pension. Luxembourg is number one. Now, you're not going to like this. Well, I'll tell you after the break how much they get paid, the pensioners in Luxembourg. It's kind of, it's a little amazing. But I'll tell you that Spain is also right at the top there, and we are nowhere near. So why can those countries afford to pay their pensioners a decent living, and we can't? 0345 6060 973, LBC.
This is LBC.
It's happened again. All you said was barrel leg. Now she's looking at you like Nadine isn't your real name. Look at you go, as you explain volume cocoon is a key shape for the season. 100% cotton, you say? No way, she says. And then, oh, a little extension of the trouser leg. Check out that pleat. Then you break the news. They're from Primark. Only £16. Be a good friend. You can borrow them. Hopefully she'll forget that. Shockingly chic for £16. That's so Primark. Available in-store and on click and collect.
When we think of Easter, why do our brains go straight to eggs wrapped in foil and not lamb joints resting in foil? Think outside the chalky egg box and enjoy a third off delicious British lamb joints. Cook them low and slow until tender enough to carve with a spoon, or roast with a rosemary and lemon thyme infusion. Chocolate eggs are only the beginning.
Save a third on all British lamb roasting joints at Waitrose, the home of food lovers.
Selected lines and stores subject to availability. Prices may vary in Channel Islands, Little Waitrose and Partners, and concessions offer in 6th of April.
Leading Britain's conversation, Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
So, pensioners will start to see increases in their state pension from tomorrow. It's the first full week of the new tax year. The annual rise won't kick in for everybody all at the same time because of the different ways in which people get paid. But more than 12 million people will see their state pension rise by about £575 a year. The triple lock guarantee means it increases every April by whichever is highest out of inflation, wage growth, or 2.5%. And so because inflation is high, it's going up by 4.8%. That's in line with earnings growth. And we'll take the full rate of the new state pension from £230.25 a week to £241 a week, which in some parts of the country is enough to buy you a pint of lager and a packet of crisps. Meanwhile, I'll go from the bottom up. We're the sixth richest economy in the world, but we are also keep being told that the state pension is not affordable anymore. I think it's them buttering us up for the announcement eventually that that's it, it's over. This was the figure as of last year. The UK pension paid out is £997, which is about 121% above break-even level. In other words, the amount that you would spend on an ordinary month, the pension would cover 121% of it. So it's gives you a little leeway, but not enough to treat yourself or go on holiday or, call the plumber out too often. Ireland gives more than we do. Switzerland gives more than Ireland. The Netherlands gives more than Switzerland and Ireland and us. And if you have the level that they give in the Netherlands, you're at 155% above break even, which is significantly more. You start to be able to treat yourself. France is more generous than that. Denmark is more generous than France. Belgium is more generous than everybody that I've mentioned so far. Then it comes Sweden. And when you get to Sweden, you are on 173% above break even level. Because, this is very much dependent on the cost of living. Which is quite high in Sweden, but it's 173%. So they get £1,373 a month. Norway is even more generous than that. Spain is extra generous, 205% above income break-even level. £1,238 a month. So it's double the cost of your average monthly outgoings. A very comfortable retirement indeed. Luxembourg tops the list. Grip onto something firm. It's almost 600% above income break-even level. And pensioners in Luxembourg earn in 1 month £5,426. Why can't we afford that? 0345 6060 973. Newbury, hello, Alan.
Hello, Nick. Very interesting, thank you. I think there's two things. I think the first thing is planning, and the second thing is how much money you put into the system in the first place. So if I go back to planning, I'm 72 years old now, and if I go back to 1972, I was doing my degree at university, and it was, and we did some stuff on the population, and it was quite obvious how many people in the bulge of the baby boomers were actually going to be, where we are now, and some would pass away sadly, and sadly more men would pass away than women, but at the end of the day, you knew there was going to be this bulge. And I don't think the UK is very capable of planning anything more than about 4 years in advance.
Well, that's the political cycle, isn't it? But you would think that that would be the same for every country.
Not sure. We spent some time in France, and I think two things struck us about France. One was that there was a longer term view of life. And the second was that everybody paid broadly about 50% of their income in social, whether it was the equivalent of NI or tax or whatever. Hmm. At the end of the day, they actually put more money in, and that's what drives it. And even then, people had to top up when they retired in any case. So the figures may sound great on the surface, but what you put in is what you get out, basically, from that perspective. But I think, my first comment when I phoned up was basically to say, this was totally predictable 50 years ago.
Well, it does seem extraordinary that you pay into this scheme that is supposed to take care of you in your old age, and you do that for your entire working life, whether you like it or not. And then you come to the end of your working life and you look to this pot that is supposed to have grown through compound interest and, the careful husbandry of that pot, and you find that it is not a lot. It seems like we've been conned.
Well, I think first of all, it was an agreement, at the time, NI and whatever paid for it. At the end of the day, the pension is a final salary thing, in a way, because, it's not going to be what the pot is for any one individual, because you're going to get whatever, 12,000 a year or 11,000 a year or whatever, at the moment. So, so that's not really the issue. I think the issue is, what does the government do with the money in the meantime? Because I think there's, the government likes to look at big pots of money and do something with them. Which, so anyway, that's a political thing. But I think in the main, you know, whether it's 3%, 2%, 4% or whatever, whether it's a triple lock or not the triple lock, the pensions are, you know, they're going to go up. But I think the bigger issue is the fact that, you know, where is the next generation of people who are actually going to pay?
Well, that's right. I mean, people are calling it a Ponzi scheme because those who got in early, those who are retired now, they have benefited the most. It's the people who are coming up now who are paying into the system and who are, by dint of working and paying their wages, will be funding the pensions for the older people who are drawing their pension now. But it's not going to be available to those younger people who are now paying in. Therefore, it does look like a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, but in 1972, we didn't have people like you who were on the, because I paid in for 40 years, you know. So at the end of the day, you know, it's a cyclical thing. And what I was trying to get over was, on the first point, was really, you know, this is a long-term churn. And it comes down to how many taxpayers. At the moment, we've got a bulge of pensioners. Sadly, I would think that the baby boomers, if we have this conversation in 20 years' time, you know, sadly, a lot of us won't be here. And the question then is, you know, do you keep philosophically the same approach going all the time?
Yes, well, as you've described, that is a conversation that we should be having immediately and not wait another moment. All right, more of your calls to come on that subject. I'm going to take a break for the news. Immediately after which, you will have heard a lot about shoplifting lately. Shop owners say they are being besieged by thieves. So what's being done about it, and can they do more themselves? I'll speak to a retail leader who wants to see tougher action than they're getting at the moment. The number here, 0345 6060 973. It's 11:30 on LBC, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
Jordan's military says it's been intercepting missiles and drones over its territory tonight after they were fired from Iran. The news has come on the same evening. President Trump said he expects Tehran to make a deal with the US and Israel in days, not weeks. Reports a British warship had been struck by Hezbollah missiles in the Mediterranean are being dismissed by a source inside the Ministry of Defence. Posts on social media have been claiming it was damaged after being mistaken for an Israeli vessel. And a 20-year-old man has died following a road collision in County Antrim. Police were sent to Durvook just before 1 o'clock this morning and say he was the driver of a BMW. LBC weather, a calmer night across most of the UK, but it will become cold, clear skies and mostly dry for most areas. Apart from Scotland, we'll see a low of around 2 degrees.
This is LBC.
When it comes to retirement advice, the last thing you want is to be put in a bucket. Seen as this type of person, or that type of person. At Fisher Investments UK, we never put you in a bucket. We always tailor retirement advice that's just right for you. Fisher Investments UK, retirement advice that's as individual as you are. Learn more at fisherinvestments.co.uk. Investing involves the risk of loss. Fisher Investments UK is regulated by the UK Financial Conduct Authority.
Next.
Hi, just these, thanks. Do you do cashback?
Just need to check you're not a robot first. New security policy.
Okay.
How many traffic lights can you see out the window?
Two?
No, that's wrong.
Right, well, obviously I'm not a robot.
That's what a robot would say.
What a load of malarkey. Smarty keeps things simple, like 80 gigabytes for £10. And on a rolling monthly SIM plan, you're free to leave any time. Less malarkey, more Smarty. Search Smarty Mobile.
When we think of Easter, why do our brains go straight to eggs wrapped in foil and not lamb joints resting in foil? Think outside the chalky egg box and enjoy a third off delicious British lamb joints. Cook them low and slow until tender enough to carve with a spoon. Or roast with a rosemary and lemon thyme infusion. Chocolate eggs are only the beginning.
Save a third on all British lamb roasting joints at Waitrose, the home of food lovers.
Selected licensed stores subject to availability. Prices may vary in Channel Islands, Little Waitrose and Partners and Concessions. Offer ends 6th of April.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Retail businesses, particularly supermarkets, have seen an increase in shoplifting. In England and Wales, there were over 500,000 shoplifting offences in the year to September 2025. That's up 5% from the previous year. In February, the Retail Trade Trade Union, USDAW, said workers faced what they called unacceptable levels of violence and abuse, with evidence showing that two-thirds of attacks on retail staff are being triggered by theft or armed robbery. On Friday, the chief executive of Marks & Sparks called on the government and London's mayor to crack down on retail crime, saying it had become more brazen, more organised and more aggressive. Let's talk about this with Andrew Goodacre. Andrew is the CEO of the British Independent Retailers Association and joins us on the line now. Hello, Andrew.
Hello, good evening.
So shoplifting seems to be at record highs. Last year it went up 20% on the previous year and up 55% since we came out of COVID lockdowns. That seems like a big increase. Is it really happening so much more, or are shopkeepers just reporting it more?
Both, in fairness. The 500,000 is the number of reported crimes, but there's been two significant surveys across the retail sector recently, and they show that the level of crime is at a record high. It is indeed levelling off, but we're talking many, many more offences taking place, either staff abuse or people stealing from shops. So it has been a severe problem now for the retail sector for 3 years.
Is it spur-of-the-moment stuff, or is it more organised crime?
I think there's always been an element of stealing from shops. We've seen it over the years. What's happened in the last 3 years is almost on an industrial scale, which suggests that there is a degree of quite a lot of organisation behind it. The sector spent almost £1 million supporting a special police unit looking at organised crime, looking at dismantling some of the elements of those crime gangs. And there's been some successes there, so that's welcome. But it's maintaining that momentum and making sure that we can overcome this problem once and for all.
Is there perhaps a hint of the public feeling aggrieved, particularly towards the larger retailers? Because prices went up by 25% in the 2 years after COVID, 2022 to 2024, it went up a quarter. Wages, in the meantime, fell in real terms. And it felt like people were being ripped off. That was what some people thought was happening. The biggest of our supermarkets made £730 million in clear profit in 2023 alone, for instance. Did it seem like shoplifters were thinking, well, we're going to get our own back a bit?
No, I think the theft from shops has been through organised crime. I think the event in Clapham, where we saw gangs of youths taking hold of shops effectively and being very disruptive. I think disrupting big retail businesses like Marks and Spencer's, that is happening, and they have become targets, maybe because of their Jewish heritage, maybe because of different reasons. But it seems that there's different sorts of crimes that retailers are having to now deal with. We were warned 2 or 3 weeks ago by the police authorities that there would be some, I think it's called take back action groups, which were groups stemming from other environmental groups who wanted to go into stores and be disruptive, targeting Sainsbury's, targeting Marks and Spencer's. I think they were largely controlled. I think the Clapham was a separate event to that even, but took everyone by surprise. So, yes, retail is targeted, but what people need to understand, I think, is that they work incredibly hard to deliver food that people can buy to put on their plates. And inflation doesn't benefit retailers any more than it does the general public, because when inflation is higher, people spend less. And that's as simple as that. So I think the idea that retailers are profiteering, I think, is mistaken. Yes, they've made more profits because people have been spending more in supermarkets than they have in maybe independent shops.
Right. That was kind of an answer, but not yes. really. I mean, I would dig my heels in a bit and say yeah. that when people found that supermarkets, particularly the big ones, were making hundreds of millions of pounds in profits that they did not make before COVID, and so they sort of joined the rush to increase the price of everything, then people did feel as though, well, you know, why are these prices as they are now when there doesn't seem to be any justification for it?
Well, I do think there has been justification for retail across the piece, not just supermarkets. If we look at supply chain inflation that occurred as we came out of COVID, the cost of shipping items, the cost of importing items rose significantly. In the past 2 years, the cost of national insurance contributions on the retail sector has cost many, many millions of pounds because we are the biggest employer, private employer in the UK. So when national insurance and national living wage and minimum wages go up, it's entirely feasible that the retail sector will feel the brunt of that. And so all these extra costs and the cost of energy, of course, impacted the supermarkets just as much as any other part of the high street.
No, I understand.
All that was happening.
Yes.
And yes, I hear what you're saying. So how have they made more money?
Exactly.
Yes, it's a fair challenge. I think, irrespective of what's been happening, the large companies are very adept at streamlining their businesses. They have introduced automation. We've seen the introduction and increasingly so of self-service tools. We see other ways within the supply chain of them being more efficient in terms of managing from producer to customer. And all that adds up and all those savings count. And invariably, they're very good, therefore, at converting sales, which is very much a high sale, low margin environment, especially mm-hmm. on food
yeah.
products.
Yeah.
But they've become very good at raising that. Now, I think it's a fair challenge to say, well, could you not do more to help the general public? But they do need to generate profits to reinvest back in their business to make those ongoing savings to protect
yes, but they,
future increases.
Well, they didn't really, did they? They did share buybacks of £700 million. So they just benefited the shareholders. But let's not get bogged down in that.
Sure.
I'm just saying that is perhaps one of the reasons that people might think that it's not so serious to take eggs or a bottle of whiskey or whatever from a supermarket if they feel that supermarket is engaging in price inflation for no reason other than greed.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying, and but I still don't think it justifies crime to that nature,
right.
In fairness. But I don't think that is behind the large increase we've seen in theft from shops.
No, it's more opportunist, isn't it? That's
what
I'm describing.
I don't think it is. Yeah, that is more opportunist. I think what we've seen is a stronger group of people realizing that you don't have to break into a shop, you walk into a shop, and what we used to see were people trying to hide things in pockets of coats and so on. We now see people simply emptying a shelf of cosmetics into a bag for life and walking
yes.
out.
Well, do you think the low-value shoplifting policy has had, whereby the police might not attend
yeah.
if what has been taken is under £200 in value?
Yeah, I think that was an error. The police and various governments now have accepted that. It's changing in the future. And when the Police and Crime Bill becomes an act, that level is being removed. But I think what it gave unintentionally was a message to criminals that said, if you still bear £200, then we may not well attend. And so you are giving, and the people who are stealing are not necessarily unintelligent. They're quite adept at what they do. You know, they're very skilled at what they do. I don't approve of what they do, but many of them are very skilled at what they're doing. So they soon realize where the opportunities lie. And those kinds of messages have been detrimental. It's given the impression that this is a victimless crime. And actually, you know, we've talked a lot about the large supermarkets, a lot of small retailers whose businesses and livelihoods depend on the success of their shop have also been victims of crimes in a much bigger way than they were 3 or 4 years ago. And that's their livelihoods that's being stolen. It's not the shareholders' funds. It's not the chief executives' big wages. This is literally their lifeblood on the shelves. And what we are hearing is that whether you run a small pet shop or a small fashion shop or a small gift shop, you are being victim of increasing amounts of abuse and increasing amounts of theft, which is why we're seeing more and more shops really struggle on our high streets as well.
Yes. If the police don't attend, should shop staff thereby get involved themselves? There was a story about the chap in Waitrose just today, yeah. An employee of 17 years, who described his state of mind as being devastated after he was sacked for stopping a shoplifter who had taken a load of Easter eggs off the shelf. A person who is a repeat shoplift offender. And they fired him.
I'm surprised by that. I don't work for Waitrose. I'm generally surprised in the way a person like that has been treated. I know the large chains, and in fact any employer, has a duty of care to employees. And I think it's important they have guidelines on what employees should do in certain circumstances, whether that is in a fire, whether that's in an accident, or whether that's someone stealing from their shop. And people are more important to the employers than product. But having said all that, I represent independent retailers, and I talk about these people who are seeing their savings disappear from the shelves. They are more likely to become involved and try to prevent someone stealing from them because it's their money that's being stolen from them. And I think if you've worked in somewhere for 17 years and you show that kind of commitment, it does seem on the face of it incredibly harsh for that person then to lose their job because they thought they were simply doing what was right for their employer.
Do you think
it does seem harsh?
Yes. Do you think that the law is actually less on the side of a shopkeeper who tries to stop someone stealing from him than it is on the side of the person that's doing the stealing?
I think it depends what measures are taken to stop the person stealing. But it is, I think there's two things at play here. We don't want people being injured in the process of trying to stop someone because there's no doubt, and this has been verified in the survey by Usdaw, the shop workers union that you referenced earlier, that the criminals taking part are more belligerent and more likely to be violent in return. And a very clear message from many of them is, don't stop me, you'll get hurt on the way. So we don't want people being injured and taking unnecessary risks. The law needs to protect those shopkeepers, though. The law needs to protect people who are simply trying to prevent a crime taking place. And we do need, and what we've seen more recently, are the police attending more incidents, making more arrests, and working harder on behalf of shopkeepers to prevent the crimes taking place. It's levelling off, but it's still an incredibly high number of offences that are having to be managed by retail business owners around the UK.
Is there a sense of despair that even if the police do show up and even if a person is arrested and they go to court, the court case could be years away and might end with nothing more than a slap on the wrist?
It's the single biggest frustration of any shop owner who sees the person arrested and then that same person appears back in their shop possibly and doing the same crime. 1 day, 2 days later. That is a massive concern for shopkeepers. It does explain why they don't trust the system and why they don't bother reporting maybe 80% of the crimes that are actually taking place. And that is something that we've worked hard with police authorities in the last 3 years to try to get them to realise that we've got to bridge this trust gap that has appeared between business owners on the high streets and the police authorities. It is a difficult solution though because if you put every shoplifter in prison, I can guarantee your prisons will be full tomorrow. That's just a problem we face in terms of prison space. So we do need to find different solutions. We are fans and advocates of community banning orders. That's kind of a modern day ASBO. I think if people, regular offenders, were issued with a CBO, it's been proven to be a deterrent from people going to certain areas and committing those crimes. And if they do commit crimes elsewhere, then you've got a better chance of getting a more severe sentence on them. So I think we've got to be better at managing these serial offenders, in fact, any perpetrator, with the tools that we have, because sentencing in prison isn't necessarily an option that is readily available. But we've got to do it better than we are doing now, because the business owners just don't see any sense of crime and punishment taking place when someone is arrested.
The best thing would be to prevent the crime from happening in the first place. What can shops practically do to avoid that happening?
I think I saw an interesting statistic that the retail sector as a whole has invested something like £5.2 billion extra in measures to reduce retail crime. Now, a lot of that is in extra security staff on bigger stores, on better CCTV across the retail sector, on things like product DNA, where we are spraying, certain products are being sprayed, and if that product then reappears in a shop that has bought it illegally, then that can be tracked back to the scene of the crime. So there's a huge amount being done. I think there's still more can be done. I think we need to understand how best to address perpetrators when they're in store. If you take the example of the Waitrose example, what different could be done there, and how do we help the employees have the confidence to intervene safely and without fear of repercussions from the employer? We need to do more in terms of educating the police and encouraging police to be more proactive and more present on the high streets. There's a lot of talk about community and neighbourhood policing that needs to really come to the fore and be very, very apparent. And I guess, to a certain extent, we've got to find a way of rehabilitating some of those serial offenders. It's still the rule of 80% of the crime is committed by 20% of the perpetrators.
Very good to talk to you, Andrew.
If we can remove some of those serial offenders, we do start to make an impact on the level of crime that's taking place.
Good talking to you, Andrew. Thanks so much for that. Andrew Goodacre, CEO of the British Independent Retailers Association. Now we're going to take a short break and then come back to more of your thoughts on what we were talking about before, which was state pension, which is rising by a relatively small amount as of tomorrow for most recipients of the state pension. But we can also talk about, if you have a thought about the conversation that I've just had about shoplifting. Either way, the number is the same, 0345 6060973.
LBC. Last week on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast, this outspoken man is returning. I speak of the former, now suspended Labour MP, Carl Turner.
What do you see as your political future?
I want to be back in the Labour fold, but I'm not going to count out, and I'm not going to start doing as I'm told on juries, because it's the worst idea.
Chief Executive Officer at NHS England, Sir Jim Mackey.
In every area, we've got enough to get through for a reasonable period.
What's a reasonable period?
So generally a few weeks.
Defence Secretary John Healey. How many frigates do we have in the fleet?
We have 17 frigates and destroyers.
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast, back Tuesday morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
When we think of Easter, why do our brains go straight to eggs wrapped in foil and not lamb joints resting in foil? Think outside the chalky egg box and enjoy a third off delicious British lamb joints. Cook them low and slow until tender enough to carve with a spoon or roast with a rosemary and lemon thyme infusion. Chocolate eggs are only the beginning.
Save a third on all British lamb roasting joints at Waitrose, the home of food lovers.
Selected lines and stores subject to availability. Prices may vary in Channel Islands. Little Waitrose and Partners and concessions offer in 6th of April.
Next.
Hi, just these, thanks. Did you cash back?
Just need to check you're not a robot first. New security policy.
Okay.
How many traffic lights can you see out the window?
Two?
No, that's wrong.
Right, well, obviously I'm not a robot.
That's what a robot would say.
What a load of malarkey. Smarty keeps things simple, like 80 gigabytes for £10. And on a rolling monthly SIM plan, you're free to leave any time. Less malarkey, more Smarty. Search Smarty Mobile.
OK, who's all in for Cancer Research UK's Race for Life?
We're doing Pretty Muddy.
It's an obstacle course.
There's one for kids.
Runners.
Walkers.
Book clubbers.
Knit clubbers.
Tenpin bowlers.
Choir singers.
Lake swimmers.
Gardeners.
Whether you climb it.
Slide it.
Or crawl it.
Go all in against cancer.
All in to help fund life-saving research. Sign up now and save 50% off entry to your local 3K, 5K, 10K or Pretty Muddy event. Search Race for Life. Discount ends April 19th, 2026. T's and C's apply.
Leading Britain's conversation. Nick Abbott. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
I should say that I mentioned that story that you might have read about the chap that had worked at Waitrose in Clapham Junction for 17 years. And he intervened when he saw a repeat offender shoplifter try to get away with a bunch of Easter eggs. And he was fired for that. And it's fair to give the Waitrose perspective. A spokesperson for Waitrose said, "We take the safety and security of our customers and our partners incredibly seriously. And to do this, we have policies in place which our partners are aware of and are required to follow. As a responsible employer, we never want to be in a position where we are notifying families of a tragedy because somebody tried to stop a theft." Waitrose said it couldn't discuss individual cases, but the correct process was being followed, which included a standard appeals process. Now, more of your calls on what we were talking about before, which was the state pension and its generosity and affordability. Birmingham, Neil.
Hello there, you all right?
Yes, good, thanks.
Yeah, good. Yeah, it's just like, I don't know, it's the whole thing about it. I think the poor people that haven't got another pension to back it up, you know, and if they're going to live on a state pension, there ain't much there, is there?
No,
there isn't.
It's pretty much dependent on you owning your own house, because other than that, it'd be very difficult to make ends meet, I think.
Yeah, it's a struggle, and I think the way that they, what is it they call the free thing, or whatever they do.
Triple lock.
It's a real good thing. I think they should keep that, you know. But if the really wealthy people can afford to say they don't want it, is there a system to do that? Just say, to click it back and say, you know what? Don't want it, you know, put it back in the system.
Well, they could generously do that, I suppose, but if they are wealthy, then it's quite likely that they would have earned more than average during the course of their working life, which would have meant that they would have paid in more than the average person, so why shouldn't they take?
Well, basically, I don't know. In my little world, it's a nice thing to do.
Right, being nice, yeah. Okay, whatever happened to nice,
I'm an ex-military man, so I've got a pension, and, you know, we're all right in our little world. But if there is a big old... how many rich people do pay it back?
I don't know. It might be a number adjacent to zero.
That might be a question, mightn't it?
All right. Okay, good talking to you, Neil. Thanks for that. 0345-6060-973. Kensington, Jennifer.
At last, I've been on the phone almost an hour.
Ah, there you are. Sorry about that, Jennifer.
I celebrated my 77th birthday last Friday.
Oh, yes.
And 2 days before, I received the letter I get every year telling me my state pension would be going up.
Oh.
And it's actually going up by a fantastic £8.72.
Oh.
And that will take me to a weekly amount of £191.45. And the government thinks that's enough for me to live on. That's what it always says in the letter. But fortunately, I took Margaret Thatcher's advice when I was 40 years old. Although I didn't vote back in those days, she said, people of my age group, by the time we retire, there may not be a state pension. So she advised people of my age group to start up a private pension, which is what I did. But it's not a great deal because I'm still on benefits. So I get my rent paid and my council taxes paid. If I didn't get those benefits, I wouldn't be able to, I don't know, buy clothes, buy toiletries, whatever. So even though I've got a private pension, it's not enough combined with the state pension. So I also get housing and council tax benefit. And I just think it's wrong that people who are millionaires and got millionaire houses are actually getting the state pension. Okay, they paid into it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they don't need that money. If they all said to the government, we don't need it, we can do without it, we're not going to miss it, then people which are getting a state pension, but not the full state pension, because I'm not getting the full state pension, and I paid my tax insurance for 40 years in this country.
Yeah.
I worked for 40 years, always paid it. And I just think that all those state pensioners, all those pensioners who are getting a lot less than I'm getting, and then some of them are living on the poverty line, then all those wealthy people that don't need it and won't miss it, if they said to the government, we don't need it, we don't want it, we're not going to miss it.
Right. But I think the possibility of that happening is vanishingly small, because what we know from people who've got a lot of money is that too much is never enough. But thanks for that, Jennifer. I just want to squeeze one more in before the news. Kingsbury, hello, Steve. Oh, couldn't do it. Steve's not there. Never mind. Better luck next time. Now, coming up after midnight, we will be talking to our US correspondent for the latest from there. But immediately after midnight, the Royals put on a brave face today when they attended an Easter service at St. George's Chapel in Windsor. It marks their first public outing since the black sheep of the family, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, was arrested on suspicion of misconduct in public office. The former prince has been engulfed by the Epstein scandal, but he strongly denies any wrongdoing. But as questions into Epstein continue, calls are growing for taxpayer funding to the family to be slashed. So should the Royal Charter be reviewed? 0345 6060 973. Friday, Saturday, Sunday night at 10. Nick Abbott, LBC.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at midnight. The American-born Pope has used his first Easter address to call on world leaders to abandon every desire for conflict, domination and power. Although Leo didn't mention President Trump specifically, he did refer to those who have the power to unleash wars. Donald Trump has told Iran it has until Tuesday to reopen the Strait of Hormuz to all shipping or face concentrated attacks on its infrastructure. The former Conservative Defence Minister, Tobias Elwood, has been telling LBC he thinks the President has boxed himself in.
The idea that he might now start attacking infrastructure, it is a war crime. Nuclear reactors have already been targeted. I mean, how mad is that to consider, you know, what lessons have we learned from Chernobyl and so forth? You don't target nuclear reactors. And there are a number of civil reactors functioning today, and they're now, I'm afraid, in the crosshairs of what seems to be the United States.
The Israeli military says it's trying to locate four people thought to be trapped beneath rubble following an Iranian missile attack in Haifa. The country's emergency service also says nine have been taken to hospital after a residential building was hit. A further seven people have been arrested over demonstrations near a US airbase in Suffolk. They were detained at RAF Lake and Heath on Sunday morning on the suspicion of supporting the banned group Palestine Action. Two people were arrested there over the obstruction of a road on Saturday. Payments from the state pension will rise for 12 million people from today. They're due to increase by around 4.8% under the triple lock guarantee, but the political editor at HuffPost, Kevin Schofield, has been telling Nick Abbott on LBC the mechanism probably won't last.
Ultimately, it will need to go at some stage because, quite simply, with all the other competing demands on the public purse, it is not affordable. But no one is willing to be the first party to do it. You would need, I think, all the parties to jump at the same time, and right now I just don't see that.
The NHS is urging patients in England not to put off getting the care they need during the upcoming strike by resident doctors. They're due to walk out from hospitals on Tuesday. The Health Secretary has described the action as disappointing. And in sport, Leeds United are through to their first FA Cup semi-final in nearly 40 years. It's thanks to a 4-2 win on penalties at West Ham. The visitors had led 2-0 but conceded twice in stoppage time. LBC weather, a calmer night across the UK, but it will turn cool. There'll be clear skies and it'll stay mostly dry for much of the country apart from Scotland. We'll see a low of around 2 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Tim Daly.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with Nick Abbott.
The King and Queen arrived at the traditional Easter church service in Windsor alongside other senior royals. Charles and Camilla were there, but not Andrew or his ex-wife Sarah Ferguson. Andrew's daughters, Beatrice and Eugenie, have made alternative plans and also were not there. Let's talk about this and related issues with Russell Myers. Russell is the Daily Mirror's royal editor and he joins us on the line now. Hello, Russell.
Hi, Nick.
Well, so they're not there. I mean, we wouldn't expect them to be there. But to what extent do you think the royal family has been able to ride out the revelations about Andrew and Fergie and Harry and Meghan?
Well, I'm not sure they have ridden it out. I think this is an ongoing issue for them. It's certainly been a thorn in their side for the last few years. I mean, just look at things, what's happened over the last 6 months. Certainly the King's action of stripping Andrew of his titles and his honours only seemed to be sort of a halfway house, because what we've seen is Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor now being arrested, questioned for 11 hours by the police. He's still under immense pressure to speak to US investigators in relation to his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. And now we've got, you know, 10 police forces and authorities investigating him over a catalogue of allegations in the UK. So it seems to be coming from all quarters. And certainly, on the one hand, all the royal family can do is, you know, probably take a leaf out the late Queen's book of Keep Calm and Carry On. But certainly what we've seen in recent times is the King and other members of the family being heckled in public. And I think this is something they're probably going to have to get used to unless there is some form of resolution either way. And whether that is Andrew being charged with any of these charges that he is facing, I mean, that may sort of land them in hotter water. I mean, it's certainly an extraordinary situation for them to still be dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, you say that the Queen's mantra was keep calm and carry on. The other one was never complain, never explain. I mean, how effective is that as a doctrine these days?
Well, I think we've seen a certainly unprecedented series of statements, not only from the King and Queen. I mean, they both said certainly that their thoughts were with the victims. And just before Andrew was arrested, I remember being in Saudi Arabia waiting for Prince William to arrive. And we had a meeting with his chief of communications, who came in and said, you know, we've got a statement from the Prince and Princess of Wales as well. They were talking, they wanted to release statements saying about how deeply disconcerned they were at the continued allegations that were coming out as a result of the latest tranche of files released by the US State Department relating to Jeffrey Epstein. Then, of course, he was arrested. Then, you know, we've had another couple of statements in recent weeks from the King talking about his profound concern. I thought it was very interesting the language used by the King, saying, "Let me state clearly, the law must take its course." And I think we've certainly moved on from the never complain, never explain mantra, because this is a situation that the royal family and indeed everyone at Buckingham Palace realizes that the public view very, very seriously. And, you know, if it is not handled appropriately, and that is now in the hands of the authorities, it seems, then, you know, it could have a severe effect on the royal family. I think it has already had an effect. There's certainly when you look at public opinion, as I do in my job most weeks, I think that this is something that the public feel very, very strongly over.
Yeah, but Andrew's been stripped of his titles and of his vast mansion, but he's still there, isn't he? He's still photographed gadding about the place. But what else can the family do?
Well, what else can they do? I mean, the king has done everything in his power, I suppose. He has kicked him out of his 30-room mansion. He no longer funds him. He stripped him of his security. I think the king, by saying it, he no longer funds him, he has stripped him of his rather handsome allowance, but he will still be paying for his upkeep because Andrew's finances have always been very, very opaque. No more so than being forced at the steps of the court to pay his former sex accuser, Virginia Giuffre, the late Virginia Giuffre, £12 million to make a court case go away. And so, yes, you're right. He sort of has been banished from the public and private roles. Certainly, as we've seen today, he's not anywhere near the family. But he is sort of still hanging around like a bad smell. And until, you know, the police charge him with any of these allegations, and let's not forget he has always denied the allegations in front of him relating to Jeffrey Epstein. We haven't heard him make comment on the charges of potential misconduct in a public office, which he was arrested for. But I still think there's a long way to go for with all this.
William has been written about as being tough and unforgiving in relation to Andrew. Do you think it's been forced on him, or is that who he is?
Well, I mean, you're probably referring to the book I've just published, which is about William and Catherine, the joint biography. And, you know, in the research for the book, I exclusively revealed that William was the one person probably in the room at that time of the BBC Newsnight interview in 2019. And we all remember how disastrous that was, not only for Andrew, but the feeling was for the rest of the institution. And William was the one voice in that whole melee saying, you know, he has to be pushed to the side. He certainly shouldn't have no public role. And he argued that he should have no place with the family as well. So certainly he was overruled at the time by the late Queen and his father. But he still maintains that view of Andrew is completely toxic. I mean, he has behaved disgracefully having a relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. We've seen recently, because of the millions of documents released in January relating to the Epstein files, that both Andrew and Sarah Ferguson were very, very close to Epstein way after he was convicted of sex offences. And that leaves Andrew in a very precarious position, not only in the public's mind, but also with his family as well. And for Sarah Ferguson, I mean, she hasn't been seen since Christmas. And certainly, I don't see any way back for them. But certainly, you know, for the rest of the institution, I think that William feels very, very strongly that if the institution is going to survive, then they've got to really, really try to align on all of this.
But do you think that in doing so, in being tough, it has made William appear less likable?
No, I think people feel very, very strongly about the whole case. I mean, it's absolutely insane how Andrew and Sarah Ferguson behaved. Just look at the Epstein files that were released. I mean, there were email after email, correspondence after correspondence relating to them either asking him for money to use his various properties around the world, to the downright ludicrous of Andrew sort of begging to be a pet in his home because he loves hanging around with him so much. Sarah Ferguson begging him for money or begging him for a job, saying that she loved him and he was the brother that she never had. Let's not forget that this man is one of the most notorious paedophiles in American history. Now, for the royal family, I mean, they have been absolutely caught cold with all of this. There will be questions as to who knew what, which may come out in the wash if more emails are released. I think that this is exceptionally serious for the royal family. And they find themselves in a very, very difficult position because the king has been very, very clear that, as I said earlier, that the law must take its course. And what more can he do? But we probably won't see any further statement until the police investigations conclude.
Now, royal supporters would say that it's the royal family's soft power that makes them invaluable. But, you know, they pulled out all of the stops to flatter Donald Trump and didn't get us anywhere.
Well, I suppose that's up to the British government, isn't it? It's to argue that. And certainly there has been calls for the King and Queen's upcoming tour of the United States to be scrapped as well. That isn't happening. We will be going to cover that tour in the coming weeks. It is at the end of April. No doubt Trump will be again pulling out all the stops and rolling out the red carpet to impress the royals. He speaks very, very highly of King Charles. You know what Trump is like. He talks about Charles as though he's a great friend of his. I don't know the King's personal opinion of Trump, but I've seen him pretty close when they were here at Windsor Castle for the last state visit in September. And, you know, Charles is very, very diplomatic. He does what he's told in terms of the British government wanting Trump to come over here for this state visit. And I think we probably got a better deal than most on the tariffs, didn't we? But that's very much up to debate. And I think the government are fighting a lot of fires on so many levels at the moment that that's probably why they want the King to go back over to the States to see if they can smooth some more deals over.
It's probably also that it would be more of a hoo-ha to cancel than it would to just go, because at this point it would just be unacceptable to cancel now.
Well, I think so. I mean, yeah, we could. I mean, we've seen Trump's wrath all over the place in recent days with the way he's speaking about the Iranians and the war and NATO and the European allies. But yes. Certainly, I mean, again, listen, the things with state visits is it's not a question for the royal family. The royal family are going there at the behest of the British government, and certainly the government have taken the decision to go. I mean, Emily Thornberry, a very senior figure in the government, was saying that in her view, she thought it would be a good idea to cancel, and she's certainly not alone. With both sides of the political divide wanting to cancel that, it perhaps isn't a great look to go, but that's probably a question for Starmer's government and the rest of the people in the Foreign Office.
Yes, they're sort of to go. They're stuck with it now, aren't they? It's not a great look to go, but it's an even worse look not to go.
Yeah.
Do you think, looking at it overall, that the shine has somewhat been taken off the institution of the royal family, and it started to peel off when Princess Di was pictured alone in front of that famous symbol of undying love, the Taj Mahal, and it's been eroding ever since?
Well, it's certainly up for debate. I mean, it depends what side of the coin you stand on, because let's look at it objectively. I think that certainly a lot of people thought that the whole royal family would come tumbling down. The institution would be in grave danger after the death of the late Queen. I mean, she's almost aura-like across the world. People respected the Queen, whether they agree or not. And I think that it's been on the throne for 70 years, being known by most people around the world, you could argue that when she passed away, we would be dealing with something very, very different. But I look at the polls very, very frequently, and King Charles still does have quite a solid approval rating. People have a sympathy for his cause because he has had various health ailments over the last couple of years. But also, I think on the whole, people identify with Charles being, you know, a decent guy, that he stands up for the right things. You know, he talks about climate change. He's done great programs like the Prince's Trust. Now the King's Trust helped a million young people from disadvantaged backgrounds, regardless of his own sort of personal relationships. I think, again, you could argue till the cows come home with that, whether that stands him in good stead. But William and Catherine are also well liked, and maybe there will be a bigger job on their hands because of the way that the royal family are viewed by young people. And I think certainly William and Catherine realise that if you've got to stay in tune with the next generation in order to survive. And I think that the longevity will certainly stand with the next generation.
Do you think that the reason that people feel fondly towards Kate is because she's barely said a word in public since we got to know her? I bet most people in the land wouldn't know what she sounds like. Does she present a blank card on which people can project their fantasies of what a princess is?
You know what? I understand that argument, certainly, and I argue this in the book, and I have a bit objective by saying it's taken her a long time to get used to public speaking, and it's taken her a long time to sort of find her role in the job that she wants to do. I mean, she's been married 15 years to over 20. And you would think that she would have a bit more confidence to go and maybe speak up for the things that really, really matter to her. I mean, she isn't a great public speaker. We don't know too many things about what values that she identifies with. Certainly, you know, that's the argument for Charles, isn't it? We knew what sort of king he would be because he would have been speaking about matters that were important to him for 50 years. I think in her defence, Kate has, you know, really identified that this is a job for the long haul. It's definitely not a sprint. Perhaps that you could argue that's where Harry and Meghan got carried away. And certainly their star really burned bright for a little bit and then faded very, very quickly. Now, for William and Kate, they do have a big job on their hands because, you know, after they take the top job, it's going to be very, very difficult to keep in favour with young people who have found their voice, I think, and you growing Republican movements are growing around the world. And for William and Kate to keep the institution running, I think it's going to be quite a difficult task.
Russell, congratulations on the new book. Can you remind us of its title?
I can indeed. William and Catherine, the Intimate Inside Story. It's been with some great reviews, and I think that it gives you a different sort of viewpoint of who both William and Catherine are as people, and potentially may change your mind if you're not a royalist. So give it a go.
Good to talk to you, Russell. Thanks so much for that. Russell Myers, the Daily Mirror Royal Editor. I'm going to take a break and then come back with your thoughts on that. Has any of the scandal that surrounds Andrew change your opinion of the royal family? Maybe your opinion of the royal family changed when the Queen died. What do you make of that? I was quite surprised when I heard that Kate and William had been married for 15 years. And in that time, can you remember a single thing that Kate has ever said? 0345 6060 973.
Hear every side of the story. LBC.
It's the most wonderful time.
Booking Hero. On the beach does way more than beach holidays. We now offer millions of combinations of beach holidays, city breaks and cruises. So whether you fancy swimming, sightseeing or sitting on the top deck of a ship, we've got you covered. So stop booking around and whatever your next holiday looks like, get searching at onthebeach.co.uk.
Abter and Atoll protected.
On the beach.
Add more wahey to the day when you add more fun to your milk with Nesquik. Fortified with vitamin C and D, Nesquik is available in chocolate, strawberry and banana flavour. Nesquik, let's grow the fun.
From the big transformations to the small home improvements, you can feel as proud as a peacock with Wix.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
So the royal family are in a difficult position, I suppose. They began to distance themselves from Andrew after that infamous BBC Newsnight interview in 2019. He was stripped of his military roles and his use of HRH as a title in January of 2022. That was a month before he settled this legal dispute with one of Epstein's victims, Virginia Giuffre, She alleged that she was assaulted by Andrew. Andrew firmly pushes back on all accusations that have been levelled against him. The former Duke of York forced to relocate to the King's Estate in Norfolk after a public backlash. Okay, he did have a big house on which he paid what's described as a peppercorn rent for more than 20 years. But is it really much of a punishment to go to live on a private estate of thousands of acres in beautiful Norfolk? And if not, what else do you think that the royal family can actually do? And do you agree with me that the shine has been taken off, it's sort of been being rubbed off for quite a while now? And our call it what you like, our wish to be dazzled, or our gullibility, whichever way you want to come at it from, has somewhat been diminished. Not necessarily by their actions, but just because, you know, the age of deference is over. And, well, right enough, some of the things that they've done haven't endeared themselves to us. Do you think maybe they could rein it in a bit as far as the amount of money that they pull in are concerned? They live the life of... they may not be the richest people in the world, but they live the life of the richest people in the world. There's nobody on earth that has got a mansion in the middle of London with a park and a lake outside, as the house that they don't like. Goring by Sea. Hello, Ash.
Hi, Nick.
Ash.
I'm not entirely sure what they could do now regarding Andrew. I mean, the person you just had on said that his bills were still being paid for, but I find it infuriating when I'm reading up, seeing that he settled this civil case with Virginia Jabray for he paid $12 million, and the Treasury have said that no public funds were used for this. But then, where did the money come from?
Yes, I don't know the precise details. I think some of the money came from the Queen, and it was said that it was from her private income. But by what extent is the royal family's private income actually not associated with the public purse?
Well, she certainly doesn't work in Tesco, that's for sure. But I was researching a while ago when, you know, this whole budget came in, where other taxes could be generated from. You could cut the amount of money that is given to them with the sovereign grant. You could introduce this wealth tax that lots of people bang on about. When I was reading it, it said that if you introduced a 1% or 2% tax on individuals with assets over 10 million, it could generate over 20 billion, which is quite a sizable amount if you were to cut the funding that they receive.
Yes.
But I guess I'm going in circles now, but it comes back to that argument of do we need a monarchy anymore? Because I'm sure most people that visit this country come to see the buildings. They're not expecting King Charles to be in the Tower of London on the day they visit.
Well, that is one of the constant arguments that I hear whenever this subject comes up, that they do an enormous amount for tourism, and the royal family and the people that are around them would be keen to underline that. But I wonder if that's actually true, because I looked it up. There's not one tourist attraction that is associated with the current royal family in the top 20 free or paid for tourist attractions. Not one single thing. So it seems unlikely that people are deciding to come here because we have a living royal family. They might come here for the history, right enough, in much the same way as people go to the Palace of Versailles, which I believe is the most popular tourist attraction associated with a royal family on Earth. But we know what the French policy on their royal family was. Quite stern.
Yes. Thanks, Nick.
All right.
Can I just ask something?
Yes.
I know that you're on tomorrow night. Is that an abnormal, normal show?
Or a normal, abnormal show? It's a abnormal, normal show, as in, like tonight.
I see. Okay, well, I look forward to listening, and thanks.
All right, thank you, Ash. 0345 6060 973. Cornwall. Hello, Leonard.
Good morning. And, well, is it morning? Yes, it is.
It is.
Yes. Well, Nick, Versailles, believe it or not, there were other members of the royal family that lived on past the revolution, or let's say the many revolutions after that. But and there are still a lot of nobles that exist within French society that are direct descendants from the Bourbons.
Yes, but no tourist goes to France for that reason.
Well, I go to Versailles, and I do love it, I must admit. I spend quite a bit of time there, actually. I'm going there in about 2 weeks.
Yes, but nobody goes to Versailles because of the French royal family. That's the argument that is put forward to continue with the royal family and to keep them in the manner to which they've become accustomed, is because they bring in tourists. But I'm saying that they don't, because there are no attractions associated with the current royal family that are in the top 20 paid for or free attractions in this country.
No, quite right. It is the more historical people, such as, I suppose, with the French side, Marie Antoinette and Louis and all that. You know, it is very interesting and a beautiful work of art that old King Louis XIV created, you know. Shows how far grandiose can go. But speaking of our royal family, I think the royal family are very much intriguing tourists. I think I've just come back from America for the best, I've been there for the best part of the new year, and I was asked always, you know, there was always lots of curiosity about Prince William, and they're still very much thought about, and they're still of great interest.
Yes, great interest, but then the Kardashians are of great interest, and nobody would go to wherever they live in order to meet them any more than they would come here in order to be so delusional as to think they're going to have tea with the king.
Well, it depends what type of American people you're talking about, doesn't it?
Well, I suppose so. All right, okay, Leonard, I got to go, but I want to fit one more in before we go, or at least one anyway. Wanstead, hello, Sophie.
Hi, Nick, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I was going to ask what kind of show tomorrow's show was going to be as well, so now I have my answer.
Oh, okay.
But the royal family, I know you're a bit cynical about the royal family, but I'm not as much. And they provide us, if nothing else, with the rare moments of unity that we have. For example, when Queen Elizabeth died, if you look to all the people who are lining up, queuing up, every race, every religion, every colour. The other thing I wanted to say...
That's not going to happen again, though. Is it? I mean, quite possibly to a much lesser extent with the king, but, you know, then all things going well, we're in a long period of nobody dying from old age, and I just don't think that the interest is there, as it was for the queen.
Well, of course, it was an extraordinary span of a reign.
Yeah.
But when William becomes king, and I'm not being morbid, Charles might decide to step down. But to your point about has it been tarnished, I've always, always thought that it started when in the way they treated Diana. Now, what I think is really extraordinary is they took her royal title away, and that's why she didn't have bodyguards on that night in Paris. But they didn't take Andrew's title away. They were dilly-dallying and wondering what they should do, and they took too long, and Sarah was still in the fold for a long time, and now all this nonsense is coming out. And I just think that the way she was treated was terrible. And then aspersions being cast on her mental state. None of the people who were saying that were psychiatrists.
Which is what I said, really, that the shine started to come off the institution when, I said the famous picture of Princess Di looking sad in front of the Taj Mahal, this symbol of love. And so that corresponds with just what you say.
Relationships break down all the time, but it's the way you treat each other in the aftermath. And the way she was treated was absolutely appalling. She was a 19-year-old young girl, a teenager, and she wasn't treated well. She wasn't supported, and then carnage ensued. We all know what happened in 1987.
Right.
And So I just think I'm waiting for William, and I'm, like I said, I'm not being morbid. Charles might step down. It's not necessarily that he'll pass away. I hope not. That when he becomes king, maybe that little bit of magic will be restored.
No, I don't think he's got the magic about him. But good talking to you, Sophie. Thanks for that. 0345 6060 973. It's just past the news. I would like to get one more caller on about this, but I have to take the news, so maybe just afterwards. It is just past 12:30, the news headlines with Tim Daly.
The American-born Pope has used his first Easter address to call on world leaders to abandon every desire for conflict, domination and power. Although Leo didn't mention President Trump specifically, he did refer to those who have the power to unleash wars. The Israeli military says it's trying to locate four people thought to be trapped beneath rubble following an Iranian missile attack in Haifa. The country's emergency service says nine people were also taken to hospital. And the NHS is urging patients in England not to put off getting the care they need during the upcoming strike by resident doctors. They're due to walk out from hospitals on Tuesday. LBC weather, a calmer night across the country, but turning colder. Clear skies and mostly dry for much of the UK, apart from Scotland. We'll see a low of around 2 degrees.
This is LBC.
The new single drops. The world tour begins. As artists create the music we love, you could be right there in the mix. Calling all young creatives. If you want a career in music, then listen up. Global Academy have a new 6-4 music production course. State-of-the-art studios, practical experience, hands-on learning with music professionals. Awesome! Apply now at globalacademy.com.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
McDonald's cards are here. 24 cards to find and free food in every pack. Enter cards in the McDonald's app and complete sets with over £4 million in cash prizes to be won. McDonald's cards. 18 plus UK only with selected meals subject to availability. Ends 27th of April. App may be required. See mcdrules.co.uk.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060 973.
Still to come in this half hour, we're going to be talking to our US correspondent for the latest eye-opening revelations from there. We'll also be talking about the changes in the tax laws that have come into being, it being the new tax year. But let me take this call about the royal family before we get into that. From Port Seton, this is George. Hello, George.
Hello.
George.
Hi.
Yes, George, what would you like to say?
Oh, hi. Sorry. I'm just going to listen to the program.
George, I can't hear a word you're saying. Could you speak directly into the phone?
Hello.
There you are.
Sorry about that. I'm just saying, I was listening to your program for Monkey, and I do have to agree, the shine has lost a bit, but I wouldn't say it's tarnished.
Right, okay, so the shine has come off a bit, but it hasn't been tarnished. So you are, so what are you saying then as far as the future of the royal family is concerned?
For the future, well, unfortunately, I can't see it being very bright, given the way that my generation kind of goes about it with the whole dismantle the monarchy and thing, unfortunately.
And what is your generation, just as we know what you mean?
So I'm 25.
Oh, you right, okay.
Sorry.
So how do you feel about the person that is around about your, I mean, I know he's not very close, but as far as the leaders of the family are concerned, William would be nearest to your age. How do you think he's sort of negotiated this Andrew scandal?
It's a tricky one, to be honest, because, I mean, I think he would have done what the king has done, personally. You know, but I think, as far as I'm concerned, they've done everything possible. They've stripped him of his titles, took away his dukedom. He's not a prince anymore. And I don't think there's much more that they could do. And everybody's still calling for them to do more. But I don't get what more they could do.
What about the way that the royal family is funded? I mean, could they rein it in a bit? Could they maybe give over the wind farm profits? It's £132 million a year. Give up the profits from the Duchess of Lancaster and Cornwall. That'd be another £99 million a year. And then they could just struggle by on the £86 million a year sovereign grant and the £640 million that the king is said to be worth.
It would certainly help the economy. I know that. It certainly help. It's kind of one of those things, because everybody else says, like, oh, the monarchy has too much money, which, by the sounds of it, they do. But at the same time, they also bring in a lot of good tax revenue for us as well.
Well,
I mean, if they could just live off their duchies, that would be great.
Well, that's £99 million a year, so I'm sure that they could if they really concentrated and made an effort. All right, good talking to you, George. I'm going to set this up. We're going to talk to a US correspondent from Washington, and we'll hear about the latest from there. And if you haven't heard what Donald Trump has said lately, then prepare yourself. But it is a new tax year. Let's talk about tax.
Nick Abbott on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
It is the start of the new tax year, 2026-2027. There are some major changes to dividends and capital gains tax rates, which could affect investors and business owners. Other things changing too, and for the full details on that, let's talk to the finance journalist Holly Mead, who joins us on the line now. Hello, Holly.
Hello.
So, what are the major ones? Income tax rises, are we getting any of that this year?
No income tax rises, but we are seeing a fifth year of tax thresholds being frozen. So that means the point at which you start paying the basic 20% rate of income tax, 40% and so on, is frozen yet again. So although it's not explicitly going up, it does mean that as our wages keep pace with inflation and go up, more of our earnings are getting caught in the net. So we end up paying more tax over time. And the sad news, the really sad news, is that those thresholds are currently planned to be frozen until 2031. So expect more pain as more of our earnings go into the treasury coffers.
It's a cute way of doing it, isn't it? It's not an actual tax rise, but it is a tax rise.
They call it a stealth tax because, yes, when we look at, you know, the budget headlines on the days that all those announcements happen, we see nothing happen to income tax and we think, oh, well, that sounds great. But it's taxed by the back door, really. And the name for the phenomenon of this thing where we end up paying more tax each year, even though it's the thresholds are not explicitly changing, is called fiscal drag, which is a horribly jargony word, but essentially it does mean that for most of us over time we're paying more.
Yeah, we're being dragged into higher tax bands despite not earning more in real terms.
Yeah, exactly that. And what we're sort of seeing as well is that the 40% tax, the higher rate tax band, was supposed to be for the wealthy. And increasingly, as wages go up, it's just average, very average workers, you know, doctors and nurses and teachers being dragged into this. And that's just not really what that income tax band was designed for. And I think that's why you're getting a lot of anger about this.
Now, some people have businesses that they'll be selling or other assets that they will want to get rid of, and that will come under capital gains tax. Well, is anything changing there?
And I haven't got capital gains tax on my list of things that change. Just to come out of thing for a minute there. Have you got that down as well? Change? I've just got dividend tax.
Well, it says the tax rate on these gains, the business asset disposal relief and the investor's relief, previously known as the entrepreneur's relief, is increasing from...
Oh, okay, so not CGT. Okay, got
10 to 14%.
Got you. Sorry, yeah. I was thinking it was a... Yeah, so that's not... That's fine. Cool. Okay.
And then 14 to 18%. Well, 10 to 14 was last year, and then 14 to 18 this year. But I guess that's not going to affect many people, really, is it?
It's for anyone sort of selling on their business. So business owners that were perhaps planning an exit or something, but it's not going to be something that affects a broad number of your listeners.
It's odd, though, that that's how the rich make their money, by disposing of their assets. And it's taxed at such a low rate compared to people's earned money, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's one of those ones where the balancing act isn't there the richer you are, the greater your means are to employ clever people to find ways to avoid tax. So there's a line of keeping corporate things like corporation tax and business disposal taxes low enough that people aren't incentivized to try and dodge it, because if you put it up enough, all that happens is people find ways not to pay it at all, so it ends up taking in less.
Do you buy that, though? Because, you know, people say, well, you know, if exactly that. But I think that even if tax was 10%, which seems pretty generous, if you weren't £10 million last year, then you're going to have to write a cheque to the government for £1 million. And there's no way that most people are going to happily do that. They'll do anything they can to avoid it. So it's not the percentage that's the thing that will stop people from trying to avoid paying tax. It's the amount the percentage is levied on, surely.
You think it's the absolute number? We see this in inheritance tax. It's a really interesting kind of line on a chart. So we know that inheritance tax is 40% on assets you pass on above £325,000 and a bit more if you're passing on a main property. But actually, if you look at people with assets of 2 million plus, the actual rate they end up paying is about 20 to 25%, because there are just lots of clever things you can do. And unfortunately, it's the masses that end up paying these top headline rates. Whereas wealthier people tend to find ways around it. I wouldn't know what the cutoff is. And I'm sure none of us would like to write out £1 million cheque. But hopefully, we have some of the lowest tax rates on this sort of stuff of any country in the developed world. So I think the idea behind that, whether it actually plays out or not, is to just try and get people to pay what they owe, which is what we need for a fair society.
Yes. A lot of people were working from home during COVID and have continued to do so afterwards because they just like the lifestyle. And they were getting work from home tax relief, weren't they? It was £6 a week for extras like, energy bills and so on. What's happening with that?
Yeah, so that's being scrapped now. So I think, I'm not sure how many people would have taken advantage of this, because you would have had to fill out a self-assessment tax return to claim this relief. And a lot of people who don't fill those returns out anyway, I mean, anyone that's ever looked at one will know that if you can avoid doing it, you probably want to. But work from home has become so widespread that's a real loss leader now. When that was introduced and pre-COVID, the amount of people that did work from home was so tiny that the take-up rate of that claim was minuscule. But actually, people realised during COVID that they could get this little, it was £6 a week. It's not much. It's 300 or so pounds a year. But I mean, I'd prefer it in my pocket than not. But that is gone. So that is over now, unfortunately.
What about the, what they call benefit in kind? Like if you pay for an electric vehicle through salary sacrifice, for instance, is the tax on that being changed?
We're going to see a big change to salary sacrifice from that's being consulted on, but that's more to do with what goes into pensions. You get things like EV schemes, cycle to work schemes. There are going to be question marks under those. They are being consulted on about whether, you know, are they sustainable? Are they too generous? Is it just a way that people tax dodge? I hope not, because we know that the government wants us to move towards electric vehicles, and a lot of the incentives for that have come away already. EVs are no longer exempt from road tax, for example, and I think that used to be a nice perk for people. We used to be able to get a grant for a charger if you could have a charger at home, and those things are slowly disappearing. So it would be a real shame if we did see that disappear entirely.
One thing that the government is, if not explicitly, then certainly they have it in the back of mind to persuade us not to do, is to travel by air. And the air passenger duty is changing. What's happening there?
Yeah, so air passenger duty is going up, and that's always a really, when you book a flight, a really depressing part of the process anyway, isn't it? Because when you get to that payment page, you find out that actually your long-haul flight actually only cost about £20 and £500 of it was taxes. So air passenger duty is going up slightly. Actually, the real focus on this is on private jets and private travel, so that's really where the big burden of that tax is going to go. Actually, for a family of four flying to Europe, you're looking about another £30 on your costs. And if you already bought your flights for this year's summer holidays, they won't add that retrospectively, so don't worry about that.
Okay, some slither of good news there. What about the TV licence fee? That's going up, is it?
Yes, that's gone up. It's about £180 a year now for a colour licence. And, I mean, this is always a controversial one because, you know, there's many people out there that think that's not fair and we should get to choose whether to pay that or not. Maybe people might say, well, I don't watch the BBC or consume any of its content. Unfortunately, that is a non-negotiable, and if you have a TV in your house, you have to pay that one. The one thing I would always say to people is just check if you are potentially able to get a discount on it. For example, if you're over 75 in receipt of pension credit, you can get a free TV license. So with any of those sort of must-pay bills, it's always just worth looking at whether there's a loophole for you to try and lessen the load.
You said a colour licence. Is there such a thing as a black and white licence these days?
Do you know, weirdly there is, but I would not even know where one would get a black and white TV these days, other than maybe on eBay.
And to be clear, is it okay to have a like a computer where you watch your TV, not like a dedicated screen in the living room, but you don't watch live TV, you watch everything on catch-up, do you still need a licence?
That is an excellent question. I believe if you're watching any live content, you definitely need it. I think it's always best with this sort of thing to err on the side of caution. Mm. Can you, in good faith, say, for the next 365 days, I will categorically not watch a single moment of live TV? It's quite a hard thing to avoid.
Yes. And finally, the big one, fuel duty. What's happening with that?
Fuel duty is being unfrozen. No, it's frozen still, right?
Fuel duty is frozen, yes, but the freeze, I think, is due to phase out in September of this year, isn't it?
That's it. So fuel duty has been frozen for years, and we're supposed to be seeing that unfreeze from the end of this year. I think there's a question mark over this one personally, because the petrol price rises that consumers have seen at the pumps over the last month as a result of the Middle East conflict have been painful. A litre of unleaded went up about 20p over the last month, and that is a huge cost burden, particularly to anyone who commutes to work by road or needs to use a vehicle for their business. I wonder if this one could potentially be reassessed if we don't see fuel prices stabilise again. But for now, yes, that levy is going to be unfrozen from September.
Yeah, my money would be on them backing down on that one.
It would be an easy give, wouldn't
it? Yes, an easy political win, yeah. Very good to talk to you, Holly. Thanks so much for your time. Holly Mead, the finance journalist Holly Mead. Now we're going to take a break, and then it is off to America to talk to our Washington correspondent.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Richard Spur.
Donald Trump's published an expletive-laden post on social media threatening to destroy Iran's infrastructure if they don't open the Strait of Hormuz. This morning, who will rid us of this troublesome president?
Richard Spur at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Are chocolate eggs truly bound to round? No. Waitrose have unveiled a rich number one Ruby Fruits flat egg, sprinkled with dried berries, a tangy marvel in confectionery, and the number one blonde chocolate almond croissant egg, topped with milk chocolate and crunchy roasted almonds. Chocolate eggs are only the beginning.
Indulge in a range of Easter treats at Waitrose, the home of food lovers.
Selected stores subject to availability. Prices may vary in Channel Islands, Little Waitrose and Partners and Concessions.
Get your own UK-based account manager, a beekeeper, for support with Pension Bee. Because when your pension is in a good place, you're in a good place. When investing, your capital is at risk.
You know what you're getting with a bank holiday weekend? Traffic. Drizzle. Service station snacks. The sea.
Look, the sea!
Pebbly beach. Aggressive seagulls. Drinks at a local cafe / nightclub. A late night takeaway.
Chili, garlic.
Sometimes in life you just know what you're getting, like a luxury bed and a great night's sleep. You know what you're getting with Premier Inn.
Your life's already digital, from banking and shopping to streaming and learning. So why does sorting government stuff still feel like such hard work? The government is introducing a new digital ID to make access to services quicker and more secure for everyone. But we need to hear from you. Your voice matters. Search Digital ID Consultation to have your say. Digital ID, making public services work for you.
This is LBC with Nick Abbott. Call 0345 6060 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
Off to America now to catch up with what has been going on there. David Smith is the Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief, and he joins us on the line now. Hello, David.
Hi, great to be here.
Thanks so much for your time. Allow me to quote Donald Trump's latest missive on his anti-social media site. He said, and I'll clean it up, Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day all wrapped up in one in Iran. There will be nothing like it. Open the bleeping strait, you crazy bleepers, or you'll be living in hell. Just watch. Praise be to Allah, President Donald J. Trump. So, is he crazy, or is that just the way he acts?
Well, thank you for sparing me the dilemma of whether to repeat some of those words. I think there is a debate among some critics of Trump, including Democrats in Congress, about is he actually crazy now? Is he a modern day Caligula or George the Third? Because even by Trump's standards, and we're used to him pushing the envelope and breaking every convention, this particular social media post was very extreme, and certainly there was an avalanche of criticism from Democrats and others describing him as unhinged madman and saying these are the ravings of a lunatic, and notably, Democrats saying that the cabinet should invoke the 25th Amendment, which, of course, removes the president, declaring him unfit for office. Just to take one example, Senator Chris Murphy said, this is completely, utterly unhinged. He's already killed thousands. He's going to kill thousands more. Of course, there's very little prospect of Trump being removed because that cabinet is full of loyalists. And I suppose some of them would say this is just the way Trump speaks, and there is a method in the madness, and it keeps the enemy on their toes. Richard Nixon had the madman theory of diplomacy. In the endless debate about Trump, is he malign or is he narcissistic, and how much is design and how much is it just off the cuff, this was a day when I think many people were quite rattled about what is his mental stability right now.
Yeah, you say that it is against convention, but it's also specifically against the Geneva Convention, that he's actually boasting about the possibility, if not having already done it, committing war crimes. Power plants, desalination stations, oil wells, roads, bridges, other infrastructure. That would cause widespread suffering among the people who live in Iran, 93 million people, all of which would be a war crime under international law, and he's boasting about it.
Yes, staggering that would come from a US president. And of course, worth noting that just 24 hours earlier, a US fighter jet crew member was missing in Iran, and there were fears that he could fall into the Iranian government's custody. And then, of course, I'm sure Washington and everyone else would be pleading with Iran to respect the Geneva Convention and not commit war crimes and give that captured soldier due process. And that's how this can come back to bite Trump, because, as you say, he is threatening here to target civilian infrastructure with potentially dire consequences for millions of people in Iran, and beyond the simple ethics of that and the international law, I think many would say that it's strategically a ludicrously bad idea, because of course it will sow resentment among the Iranian people, and there could be blowback for that one day. You know, there is a view that even now there are many Iranians who are glad that the US staged this intervention, because they wanted to see the back of the Ayatollah, but this would be a way to lose any of that public sympathy. Another sort of shocking intervention by Trump here.
That rescue was something else, though, wasn't it? I mean, it's difficult to know precisely what happened, because Donald Trump has been the one that has been telling us, and you can't really trust anything the man says. But if it's even partly true, then it's the stuff of a Hollywood film, isn't it? And probably quite possibly will be.
Yes, exactly. Somehow fitting for what's always been a TV presidency with Trump, you know, full of drama and stage managed moments. You know, he loves to talk about central casting and so on, and the idea of a sort of almost permanent reality TV show. And this was definitely sort of Hollywood stuff. US crewman just exposed in the mountains, apparently only really with a pistol to defend himself, and seeking cover. And as Trump himself said on social media, this race against time, this life and death struggle, you know, who would get to him first, the Americans or the Iranians? And one of the most striking things about the US operation is that apparently the CIA deliberately put out some disinformation, making the Iranians think that this man had been already rescued and was in a ground convoy taking him away, when in fact he was still hiding in a mountain crevice, and the CIA were able to pinpoint that even in a very remote area and pass on the information. And of course it was a huge military operation, I think involving at least 200 troops, not only to get him but to provide cover in case the Iranians attacked. But just to your point, I think I've noticed on social media a photo doing the rounds, purportedly of, you know, this rescued serviceman with a Stars and Stripes flag, and then if you look closely, it says this is actually AI. So we do live in an era when it's increasingly hard to separate the reality from the, you know, Trump spun fantasy.
So is it possible then that none of what we've just said has actually happened? I mean, has the chap himself been presented to the press?
Certainly not that I've seen yet. We do get a press conference tomorrow, so that might shed more light. Right now, you know, most of what we've discussed definitely does appear to be true, confirmed to the New York Times and other US media outlets by, you know, several military sources. Who at least for the most part, one assumes, would not be taking their orders from Trump. But it is a sad sign of the times that even in what is apparently a moment of triumph, those questions do linger about, yes, well, can we just take Trump's word for this?
Yes.
And of course, again, even in this moment of triumph, you know, he then stepped on his message with that Truth Social post that we discussed. And there's also that weird question of, you know, sometimes are people going to trust the Iranian government before the American one?
Yes, what extraordinary times we live in. David, thanks so much for that. David Smith, Guardian's Washington Bureau Chief. Now, I'm going to be back tonight at 10 o'clock. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on our Global Player app or the new LBC app, both of which are free from your app store. As I said, back tonight at 10. Coming up at 4, it's Ian Payne. But first, Richard Spur.
Good morning. Still to come, Britain's fattest town, Ebba, is attempting to take a stand against the spread of takeaways, eating into its high street and putting the pounds on its residents. I'll be asking how you've managed to deal with that incredibly difficult job of losing weight and keeping it off. But first, the US president took to Truth Social on Easter Sunday to share an expletive-filled rant where he demanded Iran's leadership agree to his peace terms. Thames and reopen the crucial shipping lane or face the destruction of the country's civilian infrastructure. He wrote, Tuesday will be power plant day and bridge day, all wrapped up into one. There will be nothing like it. This morning, do you trust this man to bring an end to this toxic conflict? 0345 6060 973. And now the news with Tim Daly.
Good morning from Global's newsroom. Jordan's military says it's been intercepting missiles and drones over its territory after they were fired from Iran. The news has come on the same evening. President Trump has said he expects Tehran to make a deal with the US and Israel in days, not weeks. His latest comments have come after an inflammatory post online demanding Iran reopens the Strait of Hormuz by Tuesday. Roger McMillan is a former director of security at Iran International Television. He's been telling LBC there is no outward indication Tehran is ready for peace.
The IRGC are there to maintain the regime, and that will be through the use of their Mosaic defense program, which includes the nuclear capability, which includes their ballistic missile capability, and it includes their proxy warfare capability through the likes of Hezbollah, through Hashd al-Shaabi in Iraq, and through the Houthi, and through other sort of organizations throughout the Middle East.
Oil prices have opened higher again during early trading around the world. Figures this morning show Brent crude futures rose by 2.2% at one point. The Russian military says its air defences have brought down nearly 150 Ukrainian drones over a three-hour period. They were aimed at central and southern parts of the country on Sunday night. The two-child benefit cap will officially end today. It's estimated the move will lift 450,000 youngsters out of poverty. More details now from LBC's Thomas Watts.
The cap was first introduced by the Conservatives in 2017, limiting child tax credit and universal credit to the first two children in most households. In November, the Chancellor announced it would be abolished while outlining her budget, following months of pressure from Labour backbenchers. But the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, said the decision favoured benefit claimants over working people.
Councils are being urged to do more about the misuse of blue badge parking permits. The calls come from the AA after the proportion of people holding them reached a record high.